Good morning. The Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiners will now come to order. It is 9:04 on Friday, July 8th, 2022. Can we have a roll call, please?
Kimberly Bailey.
Present.
Robert Charles.
Here.
Mary Cunard.
Present.
Cedric Davis.
Good morning.
Patricia Dobatz.
Here.
Lynette Hennigan.
Here.
Polly Knapp.
Present.
Megan Kramer. Adelisa Meek.
Here.
Diane Palacios.
Here.
Cassandra Parr. Antoine Trotter.
Present.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. My name is Patricia Dobratz. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, and I'm the board's chairperson. At this time, I want to make sure that everybody has their phones turned to silent, please. Keep in mind throughout the meeting, if you need to use the restroom, they are out the doors across from the elevators. There's also vending machines out there should you wish to use those. This is an open meeting and it is being recorded. The audio from the meeting will be posted on the board's website. As such, we appreciate everyone's assistance in speaking clearly and into the microphones. At this point, I'd like to ask board members and board staff to introduce themselves, starting with Mr. Charles.
Robert Charles, public member.
Polly Knapp, professional member.
Antoine Trotter, public member.
Dr. Lynette Hennigan, professional member.
Doug Davis, professional member.
Kimberly Bailey, professional member.
Mary Cunard, public member.
Adelisa Meek, professional member.
Aaron Yabu, deputy director.
Jared Carver, investigations manager.
Toby Zavala, executive director. Mona Baskin, assistant attorney general, representing the board this morning.
Thank you. Our first order of business will be agenda item number 3, which are our June 10th general meeting minutes. It's my understanding Mr. Trotter needs to abstain, but otherwise, is there a motion to approve the minutes?
Davis moves it.
Meek second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. We're now going to go to agenda item number 4, which is our consent agenda, and we're going to take a minute. There's going to be a couple of people that are participating via phone, so we're going to open up our conference line before.
Welcome to Lumen Conferencing. Please enter your passcode followed by the pound.
Everybody participating via phone. This is Patricia Dobatz, the board's chairperson. We have started the meeting. Board members, board staff, and the public are present. And we are just moving to our consent agenda. I would ask at this time that those on the phone please mute your phones or your devices and then unmute yourself as your matter is called or if you wish to address the board. So moving on to our consent agenda. The cases on the consent agenda appear with a board staff recommendation. The board has reviewed all of the materials in those matters and are prepared to vote as they appear on the agenda, unless somebody wishes to pull the case. And what I mean by that is you wish to address the board on that matter. So I'm going to go through the cases one by one to see which ones are going to be pulled, and then I will go back and start calling them. Just a couple points. For these matters, the way that we'll proceed is board staff will have a chance to present the investigative report. The complainant or whoever is pulling the case would have a chance to address the board up to 5 minutes, and then the licensee and or their attorney, if they wish to address the board, would have up to 5 minutes as well. And then it would be the board's time to talk amongst ourselves, and we ask that we're not interrupted during that time. Again, we have reviewed all the materials for those items on the consent agenda, so we ask that you not take time repeating on that information, but if there's any additional information that you want to provide, that would be your chance to do so. So moving on to 4A, which are cases recommended for dismissal. Is there anybody here who wishes to pull 4-1, Elena Gallagher? Is there anybody here who wishes to pull 4-2, Nicole Mueller? Four, three, Heidi Quinlan? Complainant. And A4, Ms. Wheeler. Anybody here to pull that matter?
Point of clarification, I represent, you say 4-1,
that you wish to address the board that you're disagreeing with the way that it appears on the consent agenda. Yes. Thank you for clarification. All right, so with that being said, it sounds like...
Madam Chair, just because it's my understanding, it's possible that the complainant may be on the conference line since there were six individuals. Could we maybe see if Mr. John Lee is on the conference line?
Sure. Mr. Lee, are you on the conference line? Are you comfortable moving forward? All right, with that being said, is there a motion for dismissing 4A, 1, 2, and 4?
Davis moves it.
Finnegan second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Oppose? Motion carries. All right, so that will bring us to 4A3, Ms. Quinlan. And the complainant has pulled that matter. You can come forward. My understanding is Ms. Quinlan and Mr. Akins are on the phone. Is that correct?
Yes.
And Attorney Akins, are you on the phone as well? Mr. Akins, are you on the phone? Ms. Quinlan, have you had contact with your attorney this morning?
He said he was on the phone.
I'll give you a minute if you want to reach out to him, Ms. Quinlan.
Madam Chair, this is Dr. Akins. I'm counsel for Ms. Quinlan. I'm sorry I got cut off there momentarily.
No problem. Thank you, Dr. Akins. I do have the complainant who has pulled the matter here as well, and we are going to get started with a brief summary from board staff. I would ask again that everybody on the phone mute unless you're addressing the board, please.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board, following a review of the investigative record, there does not appear to be clear and convincing evidence to support the complainant's allegations. In addition to this, I just want to remind everybody that yesterday we received approximately almost a 40-page supplement from the complainant that was uploaded to the member portal. Based on board staff's review, it did not appear to make a change to board staff's recommendation as a dismissal, but again, it has been uploaded for your review.
Thank you, Ms. Zavala. Do board members have any questions for Ms. Zavala? As the complainant, you would have up to 5 minutes to address the board now.
Like I said, my name is Robin Mueller. We'll just start with this.
Identified not even a few seconds before that that my son had felt fear. And I'm not here just as a client in this situation. I'm also a licensed clinical social worker of this board here in the state of Arizona. So not only am I coming forward with the accusation of unprofessional conduct, as a client that's sitting there and being treated like that, and then turning around and going to a court hearing and misrepresenting it. But it's also my ethical duty to come forward to this board. And I would, if any of my colleagues had done anything similar to that, I would be coming forward to this board. This is not an easy situation. I had been in front of this board back in October. And as the board, you told me to go to the judge and get approval for this board to hear this. So that way she could be held accountable and be disciplined, or at least that's what I thought. I did that. January 11th, the judge ordered, he didn't understand why he had to order it, because he thought you guys had the ability to supervise a person underneath your board. So he allowed that to happen. Can you imagine my surprise when I looked and saw that this is again set for dismissal? The unprofessional conduct that Ms. Quinlan has displayed, as far as misrepresenting facts, as far as her actual physical conduct, and even as most recently when I was asking for the records, and in her records it points out that from my ex-husband I was physically, sexually, and emotionally abused by him, and that she decided to take such an action. And when I asked for those records, I was told I was not the client, the court was. Even to the point that Ms. Heidi Quinlan reviews her own reviews and puts a 5 down so she can raise her ratings. I mean, there's got to be some unethicalness in that. That when you review yourself, it's a little concerning. She's engaging in conduct under the unprofessional conduct. It's defined as making any false, fraudulent, or deceptive statement connected with the practice of behavioral health and engaging in any conduct or practice that is contrary to recognized standards of ethics in the behavioral health, and engaging in any conduct of that practice that is contrary to the recognized standards constitutes a danger to the health, welfare, or safety of the client. Heidi Quinlan has been in front of this board for 11 complaints that have all been dismissed. There is a problem here that you as a board need to recognize. I was thrilled.
You have 1 minute, so I just want to be able to...
I recently received your newsletter. And in that newsletter, you talked about taking care of the safety and the professionalism of the profession. It is concerning that you would not put on note that someone who has had this many occasions, and the most of anyone else, I've looked at every single one of your minutes, more than anyone else, and yet you do nothing to hold her accountable, to supervise her, and she continues to seek the most vulnerable individuals that are under family court, that are striving to see their children, are striving to build those relationships, and will say and do anything to have their children back with them or to be reunified. She has preyed upon vulnerable individuals. Please do not turn a blind eye. Please come together and have some type of oversight on her. Thank you.
Do board members have questions for the complainant? Attorney Akins, this would be your chance for you and your client to address the board. You have up to 5 minutes to do so.
Very good. I'm going to let Ms. Quinlan introduce herself, but for the record, we have no further comments to make and we'll stand on the information that we provided to board staff by way of our response. But if you have any questions, I know Ms. Quinlan will be happy to address those.
Heidi Quinlan, I don't have anything to add at this time.
We will open it up for board questions. I do have a question, Ms. Quinlan. This is Patricia, board chair. Can you address the audio that the complainant played regarding having physical contact with your client?
address it in what specific way?
Well, I mean, your position on the clinically appropriateness and what the intent was, your perspective.
Well, the truth is that I never put my hand around her neck. I've never choked her. That is just not a true statement. It was recorded, and I believe that it was a setup, and it just never occurred. So that's it just didn't occur.
Thank you. Do other board members have questions for this point? Only board members can ask questions. No questions? All right, this will be our time to talk amongst ourselves. We ask that you not interrupt.
May I ask a question of the board, or may I put forth to the board that in the court documents she does state that she put her hands on my face?
We have 280-some pages and an hour-plus audio, so we have reviewed all of the materials that have been submitted, I can guarantee you.
I just wanted to point out that.
Attorney Aikens and Ms. Quinlan, I'd ask you to mute your devices, please. And again, this will be our time to talk amongst ourselves. I ask that you not interrupt.
I am leaving. So I did a lot of reading. I went through it several times. I read all the supplement. I mean, I know we do, but I read it really carefully because I know that we've been here before.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't have evidence of what happens in a room behind closed doors. I went through all of the documentation. It's very clear that it's court-appointed duties and not therapy. And that is what's different for us and our oversight. But her paperwork is very clear on what her duties are, and it's very clear from the courts what she's supposed to be doing. And the courts have deemed nothing inappropriate, and, you know, that's been already decided. I went through the police report, and the police report deems nothing happened, and they investigated this, and investigated, you know, demeanor around the investigation and whatnot, and still did not find any assault or any, you know, misdoings. So I just don't think we have anything to be clear that something inappropriate happened from what's being accused, which is the assault charge. So I would say that we dismiss it. I would offer comments if anybody read anything different than I did in all those pages.
I think it's important to note for the record and for our discussion that, first and foremost, you know, there are the jurisdictional considerations that we've talked about before, and I do give credit and thanks to the complainant for doing what we have advised in the past, which is for these matters to proceed in front of us, we need the judge's permission. And so I appreciate that and apologize if the message was that a certain action was going to be taken. But what the judge's authority gives us is the ability to review it and to review it as we have. I take very seriously protecting the integrity of the field and the public, and know all of you do. And so part of that is also understanding the structure in which we operate, which is the standard of clear and convincing evidence, and the definitions of what violations we can find. And so I think that's important to note for the record. I agree with you. To any other...
And when this happens again,
we have a civility policy. If there's any disorderly conduct, we'll ask you to leave the room. And I understand emotions are high, but I have to keep them.
But can I also have the precedence of this and the stuff behind it, so that way I can continue to advocate for other people?
I understand. I understand the passion behind this, but I have to ask you to respect that this is our time to talk amongst ourselves and the structure of the meeting. And I understand, but I got to ask you to do that, please. Do board members have any other comments? Do you want to make a motion?
I move that we dismiss the case.
Make a second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone 30 months from
opposed?
Go back here.
Motion carries. Thank you for being here. Attorney Aikens and Ms. Quinlan, thank you for participating.
Can you provide me this information?
Does this matter?
Can you provide me personal information to where I can appeal your decision and where can you
we
provide that to me, please?
Please, Ms. Mueller. We need to proceed with the meeting.
I understand. Can you provide me that information?
Contact Ms. Zavala next week.
I will do that. Thank you. You have a great day.
Bring us to agenda item number 4B, which is our cases recommended for dismissal with a letter of concern. Is there anybody who wishes to pull B1, Ms. Lowry?
Yes.
And I believe you're the complainant for the second matter, Mr. Salop, as well. Okay, wish to pull both of those matters. Are both licensees present? Yes.
They are the licensees.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I believe the complainant for both of these matters is on the conference line.
Thank you. We have too much going on this one. I believe the complainant for B1 and 2, are you on the conference line? The complainant for Ms. Lowry and Mr. Slompa.
Yes.
And you do wish to pull both matters. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so the way that we'll proceed, since the information is the same for both matters and the parties are all connected, we'll hear a brief summary from board staff, and then as the complainant, you would have up to 5 minutes to address the board, and then I will see if the licensees have anything that they wish to address the board on as well, and then we'll take a vote on each matter, but we'll hear them together.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, but attorney for licensee board is also, attorney for licensee is also present.
All right, and is that Mr. Barber?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you so much.
Sorry, there's a lot going on with so many people on the phone. I apologize, Mr. Barber.
No, I apologize, thank you.
All right, so we'll first hear from board staff, then we'll go to the complainant, and then Mr. Barber, if you want to speak on behalf of your client, or if they wish to speak, we will give them a chance to do so at that time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Ms. Zavala?
Madam Chair, just for clarification, Mr. Barber, are you representing Ms. Lowry as well?
I am representing Dr. Salamba.
Okay, just for clarification for the record. So Mr. Barber is representing Mr. Salamba and not Ms. Lowry, but it is a similar matter, so we'll hear it together. But I just want to make the members clear that he's only representing the one licensee.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Ms.
Bauer.
My apologies. Thank you.
No worries, Mr. Barber. Madam Chair, members of the board, as is previously mentioned, both of these matters are going to be heard together. They were placed on the consent agenda because following the review of the investigative record, there did not appear to be clear and convincing evidence to support a violation of unprofessional conduct. Board staff is recommending a letter of concern for both matters, which is attachment 7, which says it's a licensee's responsibility to ensure the consent for treatment plan and progress notes meet all minimum board requirements, including telehealth requirements. Additionally, it's a licensee's responsibility to ensure that all contact with another individual regarding the client's treatment is maintained within the client record. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you, Ms. Zavala. Do board members have any questions? The complainant in this matter, to protect confidentiality, will refer to you by your initials, which I believe are VU, and this would be your chance to address the board. You have up to 5 minutes to do so.
Thank you. I'd like to address the board by saying that I wouldn't be here if I didn't feel that what I was bringing was a valid complaint, and what additional information I would like to add is the fact that, you know, if any of you guys were put in a situation where you were a patient and you were asked by Rochelle Lori, whether or not, you know, I have your consent to bring my supervisor on the call, and all he's going to do is just oversee the call, you know, do I have your consent kind of thing, that sure. However, I do believe these consents, the consent that you give is limited, meaning it is not within Brian permission to go ahead, and just minutes after being on the call, unmute himself and began ganging up with Rochelle Lori to reinforce a point that a patient is either A, understanding, B, having a hard time grasping, or C, just not agreeing with the argument or claim at hand. With that being said, the only other thing I'd like to address, aside from Brian's lack of professionalism and misconduct in terms of, like I said, unmuting and interrupting the call, is the fact that Rochelle's notes about the patient, in my opinion, also lack professionalism. Some of the wording that is used, like I said, if you guys were patients and you requested these notes for yourself for whatever reason, and you began reviewing how your own therapist is talking about you, and just so the record knows, I'm a severely disabled individual. I use a powered wheelchair, and my own therapist, you know, told me that I need to figure out my own resources. When I believe that when you pay $90 an hour, you come to these licensed professional people to get that additional help that you can't find yourself. So I don't want to take up all the 5 minutes, but that's all I have to address for the board regarding these two individuals. And like I said, the only reason I'm here is because I hope that what happened will never occur again, and that these two individuals need to take it very seriously when it comes to individuals seeking mental health, to respect them and not to take advantage of them. And that means not breaking that fiduciary responsibility, that trust that you have between patient/client and provider, in this case, therapist, or individual licensee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do board members have any questions for the complainant? Mr. Barber, do you want to address the board now? And then I will see if either of the licensees wish to address the board.
Yes, I would like to address the board.
This will be your time to do so.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to be on the board and to the agenda for a very thorough investigation. I know that all the board members have read the thorough investigation that was done in this case, and I do understand that a letter of concern is recommended. I am asking that the case be dismissed without a letter of concern for the simple fact of the matter that Dr. Slipsna is also on the agenda to open a new complaint, basically relating to similar matters that are in the letter of concern. In other words, the matter that is before you today, the substance that the complaint brought forth, board staff has determined no clear and convincing evidence regarding the substance of the complaint, and therefore it should be dismissed. However, they find in the course of the full investigation issues with the notes and things like that, and that's where they are asking the board to issue a letter of concern. However, they also found other things that they want to ask you later in this meeting to open an investigation into, and I think it's totally appropriate that they do that. My only concern is that if you issue a letter of concern in this matter, you'll be tying your hands when it comes time to address his issues in the investigation you are going to vote to open, I'm sure. And I would not want you to tie your hands because you only have to issue one letter of concern, second letter of concern, and it all is arising from one investigation. It's not like it's separate incidents. So That's my two cents, and that's what I have to say, and I thank the board, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Barber. Ms. Zavala, do you want to address that at all procedurally?
Yes, Madam Chair. I will address it based on Mr. Salampia and not on Ms. Lowry. So, Mr. Salampia, I respectfully disagree in the fact that there are similar circumstances. We are recommending a letter of concern based on documentation and not having the appropriate or minimum elements on the documentation. The issue that we're bringing before you later on today is in regards to opening a complaint in regards to Mr. Salampia having a very large group practice with individuals that are not licensed and is not DHS licensed, as well as FMLA, ESA, and short-term disability documentation, which is nothing to do with the letter of concern for today. That's all I have.
Thank you, Ms. Zavala. Do either licensee wish to approach and address the board? And if you would introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning. My name is Rochelle Lowry. I really just would like to ask you to not give me a letter of concern, as it's due to paperwork, minor paperwork errors that were policy practices and have already been corrected.
Do board members have any questions? Thank you. Try and say it one more time. Dr. Salampia, did you wish to address the board at all on your own? All right, this will be our time to talk amongst ourselves. We ask that you not interrupt. And Dr. Hennigan?
Yes. So after reviewing, am I discussing both simultaneously still or separately?
I think you can do it together since okay. We've heard it together, unless the outcome is different, then we need to specify that.
Okay.
I apologize. I would request there's two separate motions, though. It would be better for the minutes.
Perfect. So after reviewing both cases, I do agree that we should, and she just mentioned it, she says minor paperwork. I don't believe paperwork is minor by any stretch of the imagination. Paperwork is what drives our billing, it's our documentation. I mean, that's our foundational stuff as therapists. If it's not documented, it didn't happen. And that's how we, cover ourselves liability standpoint. So I agree with dismissing with a letter of concern. I make a motion for Michelle Lowry that we dismiss with a letter of concern. And then I also make a motion.
One at a time. Is there a second to dismiss with a letter of concern for B1, Ms. Lowry?
Last two second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Oppose? Motion carries.
And then I also make a motion that we dismiss with a letter of concern for the name Dr. Salam.
Is there a second?
Two more seconds.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Oppose? Motion carries. Both matters will be dismissed with a letter of concern. Mr. Barber, thank you for participating via phone, and as well as the complainant, thank you for being present as well, and to both licensees. This will conclude this matter.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Minute for release from consent agreement. Is there a motion to release from the consent agreement C1 through 8?
Davis moves it.
Potter second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Oppose? Motion carries. And then 4G, cases recommended for acceptance of proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreement, Karen Bischoff. And I believe Ms. Meek needs to recuse from this matter. So we're going to turn your mic off and take a step away. And is there anybody who wishes to pull this matter? Sorry. Is there a motion to accept the proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreement?
Davis moves it.
Knapp second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Oppose? Motion carries. That will conclude our consent agenda. Ms. Meek will rejoin us. And we will be moving on to agenda item number 7. These are complaints and disciplinary matters. This is the time and place scheduled for the board's review of disciplinary matters. They will be heard by the board pursuant to the authority given to us in ARS 323281. Please be aware, again, that we've read all of the materials during the course of the meeting. If it's necessary to refer to clients, including clients that may be complainants, please use initials only. Those licensees or applicants on today's agenda received by mail a board meeting notice. It included a list of potential actions the board could take once we reach the deliberations phase. This list is not exclusive, and there may be other options the board considers. The board will first hear a brief summary of the case from board staff. Once staff is done, other interested parties, including the complainant, if applicable, and the professional will be given the opportunity to address the board. In order to give everyone the same opportunity to address the board, we ask those speaking not to take time repeating information the board already has. You and your legal counsel, if applicable, collectively will be given the same amount of time to address the board as board staff, or 5 minutes, whichever is greater. A reminder that the board does have a civility policy that prohibits the use of any type of disorderly conduct. Those violating the policy will be escorted out of the meeting room. Once the board concludes its discussion with the parties, we'll move into deliberations. And while you're free to listen, we do ask that you don't interrupt during that time. And we will first be going to agenda item number 7C, Geary.
Madam Chair, since we did this a little differently today, we opened up the conference line. Can we see if there's anybody on the conference line right now?
Sure. Is there anybody remaining on the conference line?
Oh, did you hang up?
No, sorry, I thought I heard her.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure we probably shouldn't hang up and make sure that people didn't want to stay on, but that's okay. I just wanted to clarify. So, yes, we have to call Ms. Geary.
Ms. Geary and Ms. Carlos is here on behalf of her. Try again, Ms. Curvis?
Yeah, I just told her that you guys were calling.
Okay.
So I told her to expect them.
All the complainants.
Oh, I apologize. I moved too quickly.
I apologize. I just stepped up.
Please come forward, Ms. Curvis, if you would take your seat.
Sure.
Hey, Ms. Geary, this is Patricia, the board's chairperson.
Hello.
We are getting ready to hear your matter. And just so you know, I'm here with board members, board staff, and the public. The complainant is present, and so is your attorney, Ms. Carvis. And we have read all of the materials in this matter. The way that we'll proceed is we'll hear from board staff, and then the complainant will have a chance to address the board, and then you and your attorney will have a chance to address the board as well. And I would ask in the meantime if you would mute your device, please.
Okay.
And for the record, Mr. Mackey is the complainant.
Sorry, can you hear me okay? So David Mackey, I'm the complainant.
Thank you. We'll first hear from board staff.
Chair, members of the board, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violations. ARS 3232516P, failing to conform to minimum practice standards as developed by the board as it relates to consent for treatment, treatment plan, client record confidentiality, and telepractice, as well as ARS 3232516M, engaging or offering to engage as a licensee in activities that are not congruent with the licensee's professional education, training, or experience, as well as ARS 3232516K as it relates to the NASW Code of Ethics 1.06 Conflict of Interest. This recommendation is based on the following. From 6:20 to 10:20, licensee provided behavioral health services to minor 1 and minor 2. On 6:15:20, mother signed an informed consent with agency, which failed to include 3 minimum board requirements. The informed consent also listed mother's name as the client, and there was no indication the services mother was consenting treating tool for minor 1 or minor 2. Minor 1's clinical record failed to include any treatment plan. Minor 1 attended a total of 8 sessions with licensee, and the progress notes failed to indicate whether the sessions were individual, family, despite mother being present for at least one of the sessions. Despite the progress notes for minor 1 including goals around improving coping skills and effective communication skills, licensee failed to devise a treatment plan which would indicate mother's indicate methods to be used in therapy and lay the foundation for continued therapeutic services. Furthermore, minor 2's clinical record failed to include any informed consent document like the one within minor 1's clinical record. Minor 2's clinical record also failed to include any treatment plan which would have outlined the goals and method to work towards those goals. Minor 2's progress notes are also included in a goals section which indicated improving coping skills, effective communication skills, and behavior compliance. Even if these goals within the progress notes were considered the treatment plan for minor 1 or minor 2, it would fail to meet several minimum board requirements. Minor 1 and minor 2's clinical records included release of information signed by mother, which failed to include a minimum board requirement. Additionally, minor 2's progress notes failed to indicate whether the sessions were individual or family, despite one session indicating minor 1, minor 2, and mother being present for the session. During minor 2's 6/16/20 session with mother and minor 1 present, it was reported to licensee that minor 2 had made statement that he did not want to be around anymore. During an investigative interview with board staff, licensee acknowledged that minor 2 made passive suicidal statements during the session. Despite minor 2 making these passive suicidal statements, licensee failed to develop and document a safety or crisis plan within minor 2's clinical record. Licensee represented the following regarding her steps to ensure minor 2's safety. Licensee had minor 2 complete a depression assessment, and licensee recommended a psychiatric evaluation for minor 2. Minor 2 had never expressed a plan or intent to harm himself. Licensee had a verbal conversation with mother, which licensee considers the safety plan. Mother agreed to check in on minor, keep eyes on him, and take minor 2 to the hospital if needed. It is highly concerning that minor 2 expressed suicide ideation, whether passive or not, and licensee failed to adequately document a safety plan. Even more concerning is that licensee represents she facilitated a verbal safety plan with mother and failed to document that verbal conversation with minor 2's, in minor 2's clinical record. During a follow-up investigative interview with board staff, licensee represented that after her initial investigation interview with board staff, she went into the minor 2's clinical record and entered a case management note with the care plan to show the steps she took to ensure her safety. Licensee inappropriately entered a note into minor 2's clinical record only after being notified by the board staff that a safety plan was not documented in the record. It was highly concerning that licensee entered a note in the clinical record roughly 20 months after the session occurred based on her memory. Furthermore, licensee only entered this note after board staff questioned there was no documented safety plan and felt it was appropriate to enter this note referencing a safety plan over 20 months after the session occurred based on her recollection or what the verbal conversation with mother entailed. On 8/7/20, complainant emailed licensee that his goal in meeting with licensee is to be brought up to speed on his children's treatment so he could support them. Subsequently, agency staff emailed complainant forms and requested him to complete them in order to become a client of agency, in which complainant did. Despite agency staff indicating complainant needed to establish himself as a client, complainant's clinical record did not include any informed consent document or treatment plan. Complainant did complete a similar demographic background form as seen in the minor's records. On 8/18/20, complainant participated in a session with licensee which included the following. Complainant shared a history of his relationship with mother and how it affected him. Complainant asked if he could help. It was recommended complainant open a discussion with his children about what he can do to help them. A diagnosis was listed for complainant of adjustment disorder with other symptoms. Complainant's goals were listed as improving coping skills and effective communication skills between himself and his children. It is highly concerning that complainant only agreed to establish himself as an agency client so he could be involved in his children's therapy, but mother was not required to do the same and was actively involved in the children's therapy. Furthermore, licensee diagnosed complainant when in fact he never signed an informed consent agreeing to psychotherapy services. Licensee failed to adequately define complainant, mother, minor 1, and minor 2's roles in the therapeutic process. Moreover, licensee inappropriately made recommendations to mother in a 9/10/20 email as follows. Licensee recommends the children remain under her care due to their established relationship. Licensee recommends complainant pursue his own counseling and establish goals he wishes to address with his children. Licensee hopes she can be appointed as the therapeutic interventionist due to her licensure and experience. Furthermore, licensee's private practice forms and template fails to include several minimum requirements within her informed consent, telehealth informed consent, treatment plan, and progress notes. Additionally, following a review of the investigative record, it appears the following violation occurred. ARS 3232516K, as it relates to the ACA Code of Ethics, A2D, inability to give consent. From 6:20 to 10:20, licensee provided behavioral health services to minor 1 and minor 2. On 6:15:20, mother signed an informed consent with agency, which listed mother's name as the client, and there was no indication the services mother was consenting to were for minor 1 or minor 2. Complainant never signed any intake paperwork or informed consent documents for agency or licensee to treat his minor children. On 9/11/20, complainant emailed licensee and supervisor stating he was withdrawing his consent for agency to treat his minor children since the courts will be assigning a therapeutic interventionist to work with the family. Rather than ceasing treatment of minor 1 and minor 2, supervisor emailed complainant that licensee is highly qualified if appointed as a therapeutic interventionist and it will be in the children's best interest since they had built a relationship with licensee. Licensee continued to treat minor 1 and minor 2 for 2 more sessions, each despite complainant who was a legal guardian requesting to terminate services. On 10/19/20, complainant again emailed licensee and supervisor expressing concern that they had continued to treat his children and against request agency ceased treatment with his minor children. On 10/19/20, licensee emailed mother advising her to contact her attorney for advice regarding the client's involvement with agency and what the attorney feels is in the minor's best interest. It is highly concerning that the complainant, who is a legal guardian with shared custody and joint legal decision-making authority, asked licensee and supervisor to cease services with his minor children, but they continue to treat both minors twice. Licensee, in fact, should have immediately terminated services with both minor children and provide necessary referrals, despite court appointment therapeutic interventionist already being appointed. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Do board members have any questions for board staff? Mr. Mackey, you have up to 9 minutes to address the board.
Thank you. So there's a lot of emotions involved in this. So 2 years ago, after a long and very painful divorce process, you know, we entered and we went into a global pandemic, homeschooling, and we recognized that our children needed to speak to somebody. We just picked somebody out of the insurance network, and this is the result of that. And I would also like to add just a couple of key points that I should have gotten involved sooner. I should have engaged on the very first session somehow. It was all virtual. It took me a couple of sessions when I realized that there was, in the Our Family Wizard app, my ex-wife had put a psych evaluation for my son, who was 7 at the time. That's what initiated my concern and my involvement. So I began to call the practice. I didn't even know who the therapist was. It took 3 weeks before Shelley would ever return my phone call. Through court discovery, through our family court matter, during the entire engagement, Shelley was actively texting, emailing, and calling, and speaking with my ex-wife and meeting with her one-on-one during the children's sessions. To this day, she has never returned a single email. She knows that I have joint legal decision-making. I share equal parenting time. She has completely excluded me. They moved forward with that psych evaluation even though I called and asked it to be postponed. I was not trying to interfere with the therapy. I just didn't know what it was. I didn't know what a psych eval meant. What's wrong with my son? She would not, no one would call me. And when the office staff canceled it, they rescheduled it. My ex-wife and Shelly rescheduled it and they moved forward without my consent. So I'm very concerned about, and that's the pattern throughout the entire process. I feel very manipulated. I feel taken advantage of and excluded throughout that entire process. And I would also like to point out one of the biggest issues is that my daughter at the time was 12 years old. As a result of Shelley Geary, we are still estranged to this day. So for 2 years, my daughter has not communicated with me. I sent her birthday cards, birthday presents, Christmas cards. She doesn't want me to be a part of her life. Shelly Gary, on August 19th, Wednesday, when I went to go pick up my kids, my kids get out of the car. My two younger children come over. My daughter stands between the cars and says, "Dad, I made a decision. I don't want to come to your house anymore. I have rights. It's my decision. I don't want to talk about it." And she goes and sits down. Our exchanges take place at a police station because of false accusations from my ex-wife of domestic violence. So for my safety, I ensure that we have our exchanges there so that they're recorded and that I can be protected. So my daughter goes and sits down, and my ex-wife calls the police and asks them to come to the front. And this begins, all of this was scripted and memorized. I go back to the car and I'm waiting, and my son tells me that he walked in the day prior into his mom's bedroom, and there was a telesession going on with Shelly, my daughter, and mother. And during that session, it's my belief that that's when Shelly coached them and taught them exactly what to say. When I went to go speak to my daughter, she kept repeating these words, "I have rights, I don't want to come to your house, they're not going to make me come with you." I think it is extremely inappropriate for Shelly to recognize in that environment, in that situation, to having never met me, never talked with me until the day prior, to coach my daughter to refuse parenting time. We have a standing court order that I have joint legal decision making, equal parenting time. If she had a concern, she never expressed it to me. I read in an emergency court motion from my ex-wife about that incident, about my son making a suicidal claim at 7 years old. I never knew about it. And the entire time I'm trying to reach the practice. Another concerning point for me, and I know I'm jumping around because it's a lot and it's very emotional, but they also told me on the phone when I mentioned to them, I have the same rights as their mom. Why can I not be a part of this? I don't know what the treatment plan is. I want to know what the diagnosis is. I want to know what's happening. They said, "That court order is between you and your spouse. We're not bound by that." And I think that's extremely concerning for a therapist to operate outside of a standing family court order. I think it's a violation of my rights as a father or any parent in that situation. And it's very concerning and I think it's important to note that this is their practice policies. I believe that I'm probably not the only family that has experienced this with them. This has been 2 years. And that's one of the more important reasons why I came before this board, is my estrangement with my daughter. I've lost a relationship, and it was directly as a result of what Shelly Geary taught her and the way she approached this. And also I believe that their practice policies are designed and created to alienate a parent, in this case a father. Through the court family process, the court assigned a therapeutic interventionist, Dr. Robert DiCarlo. He's been working with our family, and we had our hearing last November on these issues from 2020, and the court ruled completely in my favor. They reviewed all the information, and they realized that all these false claims from my ex-wife were unfounded. Were there issues? Yes. Did I need to improve and work on my skills as a father? Absolutely. But I wasn't even given that opportunity. If they had called me in and said, "Dad, we have some concerns. Like, you're raising your voice, you're doing this, and this is how it's affecting the children." If they had just taken that sort of the general approach of just trying to help us as a family, we would have had a completely different outcome. But I was excluded from the very beginning. If you look at the session notes on June 15th, the very first session, it says child abuse by father. On the very first session, when you're supposed to get to meet and greet the kids, she puts child abuse by father and has these horrible distortions and things that my ex-wife claimed that were in there. And it just, to me, that's very telling. So, again, I know I've jumped around a lot, but I appreciate your concern. And those are the two things. It's just that Shelly Geary, within my respectful request, is that this board hold her professionally accountable for her actions. And then secondly, just point out the fact that beyond her, this is their practice policies, and I think that they're inappropriate. So that's all I have.
Do board members have any questions for Mr. Mack? Thank you again. I'd ask you to take your seat so Ms. Carvis can come forward. Thank you. Ms. Carvis,
service, you and your client have up to 9 minutes to address the board now.
Yes, thank you. I'll keep my comments brief, and my client, who is available by phone as she lives out of state now, is happy to answer any questions that the board may have. Needless to say, I think everybody who is on this board and who regularly comes to these board meetings knows that I would estimate probably at least 50% of the complaints that come before this board are in some way tied to a family court matter. And those are obviously high-stress situations, high-conflict situations. Often parents who are very opposed to one another have very different viewpoints as to what's going on in the marriage, what's going on with the children. I think, obviously, I'd like to think anyway that all parents in those situations have their children's best interests at heart and want their children to get the help that they need to cope with that situation. I think many therapists and counselors, my client included, went into this particular situation with that goal of helping children deal with this situation without necessarily having full knowledge of how high conflict the underlying situation was. And I think that is where, with a lot of reflection and hindsight, Ms. Geary has indicated that if she's going to treat children whose parents are going through a family court process, that she'll try to get more information about that at the outset, and if it appears that it is in fact a high conflict situation, that she's going to recommend and refer that they seek counseling and treatment from someone who is more specialized in that area. I think she had good intentions here. I don't think that 4 months of therapy sessions with these children is why at least one of them is estranged from the father. I'm not going to comment on the family court matter. I'm not involved in that. But to place all the blame on Ms. Geary or to claim that Ms. Geary must have been the one that put these ideas in the daughter's head when there's obviously a lot of conflict between mom and dad, I think that's inappropriate to suggest that she's the sole reason or the reason at all. Ms. Geary has changed a lot about her documentation. We've submitted some updated forms. There are still some things that need to be fine-tuned there. She's willing to do that. I briefly want to address the situation with respect to her going back in and adding information into the record after the initial investigative interview. I was not representing her at that time, but I think that Ms. Geary mistook saying the investigator telling her that it should have been there, that that's something that she should have gone back and put there to make it more complete. She knows now that she should not do that because obviously the record is what the record is. And then if you make a note at any time other than contemporaneous, that it should indicate as such. So she has, you know, she has heard that message and learned that message. She knows now that a treatment plan needs to be a separate document as opposed to just the treatment plan being contained within the progress notes. She's made some adjustments and changes and has a form. We also submitted a form and evidence to the investigator that there's a means by which clients can or their parents can electronically sign the treatment plan. So she is working on those things. And again, I think more importantly, realizes that in this type of scenario, the best course of action going forward would be for her to refer such families to someone who specializes in high conflict situations. She is very reflective about the situation. She, too, is very emotional about the situation, and that emotion was expressed during the interviews. She very much wants to be in compliance with the board's statutory requirements in terms of paperwork. She's made changes and will continue to do that. What we would recommend or like to occur, she would certainly be willing to enter into some sort of agreement with the board for continuing education relating to documentation and or sessions with children. But again, she is going to refer high conflict families out to someone else who more specializes in that area. She is present telephonically and happy to answer any questions that the board may have for her. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Carvis. Are there questions for Ms. Geary?
I have a question. She, on one of the websites, like a Psychology Today, she says one of her expertise is couples, marriage, and relationships. So if she's not comfortable, why does she advertise that?
On the phone. So you can ask.
It's hard, like, you advertise it as the expertise that you have. And so I'm just curious, if you're not comfortable with that, why are you advertising that as the expertise?
As far as working with couples, I feel like I am, as well as working with families in contentious divorce and family custody issues, I think that the best course of action is for me to defer.
Can I piggyback on that? Ms. Gary, this is Patricia Dobetz, board chair. If you're training and experienced in working with couples and families, I'd like the perspective on not having dad's input for a comprehensive assessment or contacting dad when there's safety concerns. I mean, that has nothing to do with the high conflict. So if you could speak to that.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question. Can you repeat it?
Sure. So when Dr. Hennigan asked about working with couples and families and advertising that, you said that you do feel like you're experienced in working with couples and families. And so I just would like you to speak to why you wouldn't involve a father for a comprehensive assessment or when there are safety concerns. I mean, those two things have nothing to do with high conflict.
My answer to that would be is if there was a stress situation in a family moving forward, that a safety issue needed to be in place, I would involve both parents. Again, in a divorce situation and in a disgruntled situation, I would refer out. I
understand that. My concern is if you're versed in working with couples and families, regardless of the level of distress or conflict, if you're working with them, do you see the importance of doing a comprehensive assessment, which would involve father, and or if there's safety concerns involving father, regardless of the dynamics between the parents or the divorce situation, just in terms of your knowledge?
Yes, I.
Okay.
Yes, I see that.
And why didn't you do that in this case?
At that point, Dad hadn't engaged himself, and it was not in my outpatient practice that I was to initiate bringing Dad in. I had worked with many children where there was only one person, one parent that was involved. This didn't come to me as a court situation, so I didn't know which parents were involved.
Okay, thank you.
I just knew mother was bringing him in.
Thank you.
I have one more question. Is it common practice, if you realize that you've left something out of the record, to go back and add it late?
No.
And again, to that point, Dr. Hennigan, she misunderstood when the board investigator mentioned that it should be there, and she verbally explained what she did, and she incorrectly thought that she should go back and correct that. She knows not to do that now, and that if there is a late entry, that she should indicate as such in the record.
Ms. Gary, this is Mary Coonrod. A couple questions. You've been licensed in Arizona for about 3 years total. It shows you're licensed in other states. How long total have you been licensed or practicing in this area?
I've been licensed as a therapist since 2000, so about 22 years.
Thank you.
Can I follow up quick question? Ms. Gary Kim Bailey here. If you have been licensed that long, I'm just kind of curious if you can speak to the type of training that you've had working with families. I know this isn't necessarily built into social work or licensed professional counseling curriculum, so can you talk to your continuing education then and where you developed any training to work with families in general?
Only in my career I did I would need to get records of all of my specific CEU training, but my work experience was with children and families specifically for the first 7 years, so between 2000 and 2007. For all the specific CEU training, I would need to go back in my licensing submittals for renewal.
But you would attest today that you had formal training in that area?
Yes.
Thank you.
Do board members have any additional questions?
This is Diane Palacios. I think just working with children, one of the practices is to maybe request a custody agreement if you don't have both parents consenting, or requesting court documents if there are court documents, just to ensure that both parents or both guardians are participating. And so have you, is that a practice that you have done throughout your years of counseling?
It is not a practice that I have done. It was something that I did do in this case.
Thank you.
Questions? That okay? Ms. Gary, Kimberly Bailey here again, just a follow-up. Is it your practice to, when you're working with families, to create individual records for all of the family members and then individually treat them with a diagnosis?
Not in all situations. Going back in history, when I was working with Child Protective Services, sometimes they would send the parents separately to me. It also had to do with where the children's mental state was at and if there was issues with a specific parent.
And in this case, can you just comment on why you felt it appropriate to diagnose the father and, I would guess, then offer individual treatment to him?
Based on the issues that the children were presenting to me, I knew that it was a very difficult situation. The children had a lot of things that they were going to share, and they weren't willing to have him in the therapeutic session. So I knew that in order for their safety and security, being able to be honest in the therapy sessions, Dad needed to be sensitive to that, so offering him, suggesting him a second place where he could process that outside of the session with the children, if that's what was going to happen.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question. This is Ayala Sami, Ms. Kiri. I was just wondering if there have been other incidents where you have invited a parent to be a client and not do an assessment for.
I have not had another situation like this.
Any additional questions from board members? All right, this will be our time to talk amongst ourselves. We ask that you not interrupt. Ms. Gary, if you can mute your device, we would appreciate that. And I believe Dr. Hennigan, you're leading this discussion.
So there's obviously a lot of information in this case. There's definitely some significant red flags for me, the one about minor one. Having passive suicidal thoughts or statements, and almost leaving the safety planning to the mom, who is also in treatment, getting help. It just, the huge red flag, the documentation, or lack thereof, concerns me as well, and then going back and adding it late, whether she's clear or unclear about what she should do. I'm just, that is a concern, and just now, saying that she's been in practice for 22 years, and the very basic of having a treatment plan is something you learn right out of the gate. You learn it in your internship process. And then as she seems confused with Dr. Bailey was asking about diagnosing Dad and basing the diagnosis off the kids. Like, I'm not sure she... They're two separate things. Like, why... Dad's diagnosis shouldn't be predicated on if the children feel safe. That's his treatment. So I'm moving with finding a violation, but I'm open to hear what my colleagues have to say.
I find it highly concerning when you go to work with kiddos. It's important to have a comprehensive assessment. And at those ages, that comprehensive assessment can't come just from those kiddos. And you have two parents involved. You have two parents seeing those kids. You have two parents with custody. I can't tell you the number of hours as an MFT I have fought to get a second parent in, just trying to connect, and you have a parent who is trying to be involved, and to not honor that is really concerning to me, regardless of how you then move forward after your comprehensive assessment, but to not even do that in this situation is highly concerning to me, along with the other things.
And I noticed that the licensee has more than one license, and even one license, especially the LCSW, I'm a bit partial, but especially that license should inform practice in a very different way from what we've seen here. But to have two independent level licenses, I can understand why people would expect excellence and why it would be so enraging and disappointing when they get something that is nowhere near excellence.
I guess just a question to the professional members, because I'm like, four licenses are, that seems a lot. So I feel like, you know, that's in the back of my mind, like, you know, she's been practicing here for 2 years, but, you know, as I've learned going to conferences, each state does things very differently. And I think that this probably kind of led into what happened here. But I still feel like each state should have a certain standard, a certain uniformity. And if this was happening in other states, that's concerning too. Yet, I don't know the specifics of that state's, you know, rules and regulation, like, because each state is very different. That was just interesting as a public member to kind of see this and knowing what, you know, what goes on behind the scenes. It seems like it's just probably too much, because each state, you're going to, I guess, renew your license every 2 years. You know, are you really looking through all of the state policies for each state? And do you have a good way of itemizing what policies relate to each state when you're dealing with these clients?
And that's specifically true to some of the documentation deficiencies. As a professional member, when you look at our ethical codes, though, right, and clinical practices, that should be across the board. So I think you have a point, especially with when you're trying to, you know, impact practice standards for regulations and documentation. You know, you have to be mindful of all of those things. And then clinical practice should be guided by your training and ethical codes.
Well, and I'd like to add just, Mr. Trotter, with all of the continuing ed, I mean, aside from my curriculum for my license, all the continuing ed I have taken, and that's going to be by facilitators across many states, I have yet to see a workshop, seminar, conference that only treats intact families. So every single family CEU I've ever taken has an area on dealing with divorced families, which talks about custody and how to treat that, you know, how to deal with that. So I find it very difficult that we've not heard this on multiple times. If we've taken a lot of these trainings, it would be included.
And most ethics.
Yes.
And what glares in this case is what appears to be bias toward the female parent, to diagnose the male parent without really assessing the male parent. You know, I can understand it as long as I can appreciate that bias is in control. But we really so have to guard against that. I mean, it places the licensee in the most awkward position. Let me now shut up.
I would agree. As a public member, I think, Ms. Hannigan, you said it was red flags. For me, it's flares. I've got massive concerns to that side, and I know that you mentioned that this is the only situation in which the family is potentially irreparably damaged. And where I sit as a public member, I don't know what the recommendation will be, but I'm okay with however strong it can be.
And if I may say something, this is Alice Amik. I don't know how you need to know. Anyway, I think that one of the things that I see as definitely missing is attention to detail. Right? So based on the changes that she has made to her documentation, it seems like for who knows how many years, these elements have not been there. Right? So it's not just this particular case, but possibly, right, all her practice, I don't know how long, but, you know, it's just all of those minor elements of documentation that are not there. And I just don't know. I'm very bothered by diagnosing somebody without an assessment. That is just not right.
And I'm going to repeat what Dr. Hannigan said about minor documentation. It annoys me when we even allow ourselves to slide into that position, because there's nothing minor about it. Documentation can either save me or it can kill me.
So in the interest of moving forward, it sounds like we are on the same page. Dr. Hannigan, did you want to make a motion?
Yes, I make a motion that we find the licensee in violation of ARS 32-3251-16P, impaired judgment, 32-3251-16M, engaging and offering to engage a licensee that are not congruent with licensee's professional education or training, and 32-3251-16K, violating parental consent of a minor.
Madam Chair, can I just for the record, if I could just clarify that just a little bit. So the 3251-16P would be as it relates to 1101, 1102, 1103, 1105, and 1106. It would be the 16M and 16K as it relates to NASW Code of Ethics 1.06D, as well as the ACA Code of Ethics for the violating parental consent of a minor of A2D, inability to give consent. Is that correct?
Okay, yes. Thank you for the clarification. There's a motion. Is there a second?
Palacio, second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. How do we want to proceed?
I have initially a consent agreement. I don't know if that is necessarily strong enough based on the discussion we've had and the concern about being licensed in other states and how all that overlaps. And her being a license for a total of 22 years. But initially, consent agreement, unless anyone thinks we should be stronger.
Well, it just depends on the language in the consent agreement.
I will start there. So I'm thinking consent agreement for 24 months, having supervision 3 times a month, and she's not living here, so I don't know how some of this is going to play out because she doesn't live in the state. Taking a graduate level ethics course. I'm also taking the state out of trouble. She does have a private practice, so I definitely think she needs a practice monitor. And taking a CEUs or a graduate course on family systems, the training that you were talking about, Dr. Bailey. So either one, I guess 6 hours, unless we take one of that. And if there's a training on family court situations, also that as well.
Can I, if we're going to go the consent agreement route, I would absolutely recommend a graduate course in family systems. Even if she decides to not do this anymore, it would be all the reasons to not and all the things to be looking for to refer out. If it has not obviously happened in CEUs,
right, that's something
that has to take them.
I can agree with that. Definitely a graduate course in family systems instead of the CEUs.
I'm wavering back and forth, and I don't take offering, you know, the surrender lightly. I think one thing that's concerning is I try to reserve judgment until we're here and we can ask questions, but I'm not sure there's insight or reflection, and that concerns me. I heard more from Attorney Parvis than from the licensee in terms of reflecting or realizing kind of the magnitude of this and maybe the deficiencies that she has in working with systems. And so,
my waiver back and forth was about the safety plan and the safety concern. And it only pains me because we hear every day the parent missed. We missed the red flags. We missed this red flag. And then we have these incidents showing up that we see on the news every day. So that's kind of where it's like, I'm like, I could do a consent agreement, but I could do something stronger just because we're the ones that are kind of on the front line. We see the red flags and we should intervene. And to leave it in the hands of an untrained person that's also being treated is a little scary for me.
I think also the diagnosing the father without, you know, actually talking to him, just going based on the children's age. And, you know, if you're dealing with children and divorce, you may or may not get the whole truth, but you may get stories that you don't know. So, coming with making a diagnosis from someone you've not talked to.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I just finished for clarification. Could we maybe ask Ms. Carvis and her client what Ms. Geary's plan is? I mean, is she currently living out of state? Is she planning on ever practicing in Arizona again? I think that might be helpful in the deliberation a little bit.
Carlos, do you want to speak to that?
I'll let her speak to that, as I'm not entirely sure what her going forward plan is as a result of her relocation.
Ms. Geary, can you speak to kind of where you're practicing currently and your plans for practicing in the future?
My plans are to practice virtually in a private practice or outpatient setting.
Where would your clients be located?
I have clients currently in Arizona. As far as I know, that's what I have planned right now. But I do want to, if I may, just add one thing. I didn't get an option to, I didn't see an option to, or an opportunity to share that I've learned a tremendous amount through this situation, and in hindsight, I would do many things differently. And I'm more than happy to take whatever recommendations the board has for improving myself and my practice moving forward. I would choose to do things differently. And in any of these complicated cases, I would refer to somebody that was more skilled. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Geary.
I have a quick question for, just because we found for the violations. Since we found for the violations, just a question for board staff. Did we look at Oregon, Nebraska, or Florida to see if there was any historical complaints, or are we allowed to do that in this
thing? That would not be a situation where we'd be able to look at that.
Okay.
Once we find the violations, though, then the other states are notified.
Correct.
Understood. Okay.
And to be fair, we should be aware of that because she has an obligation to share it to the board if there were
violations. Okay.
So, I mean, with what we have right now, I'm leaning towards a really strict CA. I do believe that behavior is very concerning. But I don't have any historical information saying that this is repeated behavior, regardless if the professional has practiced for a long time. But some people, you know, you get comfortable. And you think you know more, and, you know, you suffer from hubris. And I think that I'm kind of leaning towards that on this particular case, that I am very comfortable with a very strict CA, so that there is some accountability, as, you know, you're right that the licensee didn't, you know, say a lot in regards to what she, you know, but she's still expressing remorse. You know, it seems like the licensee is receptive to our feedback. And because of that, even though how concerning it is, I'm okay, in my opinion, with a very strict CA. And maybe we can add some additional requirements in regards to supervision, or, you know, about other additional, you know, areas that the licensee should focus on, as it looks like she's going to be primarily working with Arizona clients moving forward if we move that way. So, just
keep in mind here. Would you mind then, Dr. Hannigan? I wrote it down. Was it ethics, a monitor, staying out of trouble, family system, family court? Did I miss anything that you had mentioned?
Clinical supervision. And I was going to add to that clinical supervision by an LMFT or somebody approved by the LMFT designee, just to make sure that they have that background in family systems. I know that's not her licensure, but that's how she's marketing herself.
I have a question. If she's going to be doing private practice virtually, which it sounds like she's going to do, I don't know how the practice monitor will work. And if she's on one of the cyber platforms like Talkspace or Sound of Mind, do we have an obligation as a board to notify them, because they kind of oversee? I know this is new territory because of all these platforms popping up, but how does that look, or is that something we need to discuss later?
So if she were to sign the consent agreement, once it's executed, she's required to notify any place of employment. You know, I think that that's an interesting question, because I'm not sure that you're actually employed by Talkspace, but yet it's more of a contractual. So I would like to think that they do their own research and verification on individuals that provide services for them, but currently in our consent agreement, it would just be a place of employment that she'd be required to provide the consent agreement.
But for a practice monitor to fulfill their obligations, they would have to have a BAA or something that would give them access to the records, regardless of her employer. Otherwise, she wouldn't fulfill that requirement.
Correct. And that was the other thing I kind of wanted to, if that's the direction you're going, I'd like to kind of flesh that out a little bit, because currently our consent agreement is the template requires that an individual get clinical supervision in person, and there's a reason for that. This, I think, is maybe a little bit of a unique situation, because this individual does not live here but is providing telehealth to clients in Arizona. So if you were going to go this path, I would like there to be an exception that clinical supervision, because you're going to want somebody that's licensed in Arizona providing the clinical supervision. So I would just like to make that point of clarification. If you're going to do clinical supervision and we want somebody licensed in Arizona, we're going to have to allow for it to be via telehealth. And then my other question is can the practice, do you want a separate practice monitor than the clinical supervisor? We've done it all sorts of ways depending on the situation. The clinical supervisor can really encompass their own audit and documentation review. Especially if you were to, you know, bump it up even to once a week instead of having two separate people doing similar type things, just things to kind of think about.
And a state suspension.
And a state suspension. So this is what I was listening.
Can I add one more thing? Sorry.
We're moving so fast.
If she is doing telehealth, and in light of what appears to be lack of grasping information from continuing ed, I would recommend a telehealth CEO. And I hope the licensee asks how to adequately safety plan and emergency services for people out of state, because that takes extra work. The notes are different, and I would like to make sure she's not back here for a telehealth complaint. So I would put that in.
Since, and would that be six CEUs?
Okay.
And with telehealth consents, too. So
yeah, it would be.
Okay. So we would be offering the licensee a consent agreement for 24 months. She would be required to get clinical supervision weekly. I have it weekly for the first year. After the first year, it can, at the recommendation of the clinical supervisor, you can go down to twice a month. So what I put in here is somebody that has experience in family systems. It's very difficult to limit them to an LMFT when there's only 700 in the state of Arizona.
As long as
provide clinical supervision. but family systems, and it'll go through the LMFT. We'll go through Dr. Bailey to ensure that person has that appropriate experience. The focus would be on behavioral health ethics, documentation, family system, family law, suicide, risk assessment. Anything else you want to add to that?
That was for the focus of supervision?
Correct. Okay. She'd also be required to take a 3-credit graduate level course in family systems, 6 CEUs in staying out of trouble or the equivalent, 6 CEUs in family systems, 6 CEUs in telehealth, 6 CEUs in family law. This would also be considered a state suspension. If not signed, she'd be invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remanded to a formal hearing.
And no early release.
And no early release, yeah.
Would this situation rise to the level where graduate course in ethics would be appropriate in addition to the graduate course in family systems?
I think you would.
Yeah.
I did not. I originally had behavioral health ethics, then you changed it to family systems. Are you wanting a graduate level course in behavioral health ethics and family systems, as well as the additional 12 CEUs in family systems? And
we took off the CEUs.
Okay.
Just the 2 graduate courses, ethics and the graduate course in family systems.
Okay. I'm just going to repeat it back. So we'd be offering the licensee a consent agreement for 24 months. She would be required to get clinical supervision from somebody that has family systems within their CV. She would be required to get clinical supervision once monthly for the first year Once a week for the first year at the recommendation of a clinical supervisor. It can go down to twice monthly after the first year. There will be no early release on the consent agreement. The focus will be behavioral health ethics, documentation, family systems, family law, suicide risk assessment. She'd also be required to take a 3-credit graduate level course in behavioral health ethics, a 3-credit graduate level course in family systems, as well as 6 CEUs in staying out of trouble or the equivalent, and 6 CEUs in telehealth. This will be considered a state suspension. If not signed, she'd be invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, she'd be remanded to a formal hearing. Would that be your motion?
Yes.
Is there a second?
Second.
Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Mary Coonrod.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobratz.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Polly Knapp.
Aye.
Adelaide Sameek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Thank you. Ms. Geary, thank you for being available via phone, and I hope that you take advantage of this opportunity. Ms. Carlos, thank you for being here, and Mr. Mackey, thank you for being here. All right, we will come back to order. It is 10:46, and we will go to agenda item number 7B, Ms. Farmer, and it's my understanding that Ms. Palacios needs to recuse from the matter. Is the complainant, Ms. Cook, present? Mr. Brevington is here representing Ms. Farmer.
Good morning.
Good morning. And we will first hear a brief summary from board staff.
Madam Chair, members of the board, just as a reminder, there was a supplement that was uploaded the other day in response to the investigative report. Following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violations. ARS 32-3251-16Y, engaging in a dual relationship with a client that could impair the licensee's objectivity or professional judgment or create a risk of harm to the client. And ARS 32-3251-16K, engaging in a conduct or practice that is contrary to recognized standards of ethics in the behavioral health profession or that constitutes a danger to the health, welfare, or safety safety of a client as it relates to the following section of the ACA Code of Ethics, A8, Multiple Clients. This recommendation is based on the following. Since 1019, licensee has been employed at agency as a therapist. The agency is owned by medical director and her husband, physician assistant. Licensee's written statement represented the following. In 1220, medical director had sought out licensee for counseling because of licensee's experience with ketamine-assisted therapy to address her treatment-resistant depression and anxiety. Medical director also requested licensee provide counseling services to her two sons, child one and child two, because she knew of licensee's practice and was comfortable with licensee treating her sons. Before doing so, licensee reviewed the ACA Code of Ethics and determined the relationship was not prohibited under Section A5 because medical director was neither a friend or family member, nor was she someone she had been romantically involved with. Ultimately, licensee drew the conclusion that the issue was addressed by Section A6, which covers previous relationships and extending counseling boundaries. Licensee concluded she could ethically treat medical director and her sons without risk of impaired judgment or harm. From 12-120 to 8-221, licensee provided psychotherapy services to medical director for approximately 31 sessions. This is highly concerning because licensee was medical director's employee prior to the commencement of services, during services, and after the termination of services. A review of medical director's records determined licensee failed to document her review and analysis of the Code of Ethics until after the complaint was received. Additionally, physician assistant was also present during medical director's sessions, both to administer the ketamine and also to participate in select sessions. This would indicate licensee facilitated psychotherapy sessions with both owners of agency present. A number of therapy services were provided well after agency's business operating hours. Licensee made the following representations during her investigative interview. Licensee did not feel there was any risk of harm and if professional boundaries would have become blurred or licensee felt medical director was not progressing, it would have been appropriate to refer her. It was an error on licensee's part to not document her review of the Code of Ethics. Licensee understands dual relationships as being a mix between personal and professional activities, and it can be a relationship that causes harm to someone else. In regards to a dual relationship existing between coworkers, it would depend on the relationship with the coworker. In regards to licensee being offered the position of chief operating officer, reporting directly to medical director, licensee could see where that could be a conflict in hindsight. Shortly after engaging in therapy sessions with medical director, licensee began treating medical director's sons. From 12-21-20 to 7-20-21, licensee provided therapy services to child one. On 5-11-21, licensee also provided therapy services to child two. Although child two only had one individual session with licensee, he participated in some therapy sessions with child one. It is concerning that licensee provided therapy services to her employer and her employer's children concurrently. Additionally, licensee failed to document her treatment of multiple family members until after the complaint was filed. Licensee made the following representation during her investigative interview. In hindsight, licensee does not believe it was appropriate to concurrently treat multiple members of a family. On 7-13-21, after receiving the complaint, licensee reached out to clinical supervisor in regards to these allegations. An 8-3-21 progress note from medical director indicated the following. The unethical nature of this dual relationship was not known or discussed by medical director or licensee at the time of enrollment in services. Upon speaking with clinical supervisor on 7-20-21 and legal counsel on 7-28-21, both stated the relationship between licensee and medical director is a dual relationship. After receiving feedback that the conduct was unprofessional, licensee terminated services with medical director and her children. Also, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16P, failing to conform to minimum practice standards as developed by the board as it relates to consent for treatment, client record, and telepractice. This recommendation is based on the following. Agency's consent forms from 1220 to 521 for medical director, child 1, and child 2 were missing four required elements. It is concerning that during the ketamine-assisted therapy sessions, a physician assistant is present throughout a therapy session, but consent forms do not address a third party being present for the session. Progress notes are missing two required elements. Licensee failed to document on progress notes for ketamine-assisted therapy sessions that physician assistant was present throughout the session for the purpose of administering the ketamine and checking vitals. Licensee failed to document her prior and ongoing treatment with medical director in child 1 and child 2's records. Additionally, licensee failed to document the capacity of physician assistants' participation in at least two of medical director's sessions. Licensee also failed to document the capacity of Child 2's participation in approximately 9 of Child 1's sessions. Licensee made the following representations in her investigative interview. The physician assistants typically create their own notes, so it is clear from the chart that they were present. There is a separate consent form for ketamine administration that is signed by the client. Licensee was not aware she needed to document her treatment of medical director in Child 1 and Child 2's records. Licensee did not have any documentation or collateral forms because she did not realize she was supposed to. Also, I want to add that the board may want to consider referring this matter to the medical board regarding medical director and physician assistants conduct. That's all I have, unless you have questions.
Are there questions from board members? Mr. Bevington, you and your client would have up to 6 minutes to address the board.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the board, board staff, good morning. My name is Andrew Bevington. With me is licensee Carol Farmer. I just wanted to mention that the June 30th letter that we sent over last week that's been uploaded, which I believe you reviewed, does address the allegations in the investigative report. I'd just like to make a brief statement today, and then Ms. Farmer will be available for questions. We come before you today to respectfully request a non-disciplinary agreement, such as an NDCA or letter of concern. None of the conduct here was the result of any deliberate or intentional efforts by a licensee to ignore or skirt any applicable obligations. She believed that she had validly reviewed the relevant standards and that there was no due relationship because she did not have a non-professional relationship with SW. The board may disagree with us here, and we believe that you do, but the licensee's decisions were reasonably supported by the plain language of the relevant statutes and standards. Under the circumstances, there is not clear and convincing evidence to sustain a 16-rod due relationships violation. Licensee has conceded that she should have, but she neglected to document her ethical analysis, and she concedes that was an error. As for documenting the PA's presence in the sessions, we submit that it is reasonable to read the board's statutes and regulations to only require a licensee to document the behavioral health services she provided. The PA was there to take care of the medical component, and as noted, he executed his own consent forms, which we've clarified are in SW's medical file, but licensee does not have any access to that. Licensee's conduct here does not provide clear and convincing evidence to sustain a 16P minimum practice standards violations for these issues. As we have noted, there are no standards available for this multidisciplinary approach. Licensee recognizes the importance of fully and accurately obtaining informed consent, making sure all her clinical practice forms are compliant and taking progress notes that are compliant. During this process, she reviewed and revised her forms, and board staff determined they were compliant. Now, as to the other documentation concerns identified in the IR, licensee did not believe she was required under relevant standards and regulations to document the PA's presence because he was administering the medical component and was not behaving in the behavioral health treatment. A review of the relevant standards demonstrate that determination, even if the board does not agree, was relevant under the standards. As to the ACA, because those standards only require her to document the behavioral health services, not the medical services. As to the ACA Code of Ethics A8 issue, when licensee initiated the services, she understood the nature of the relationship. As did SW, licensee did not believe it was necessary to document any clarifications with SW after she started treating the minor sums. Now, if the board believes this issue does warrant a violation, we submit 16Q, failing to maintain adequate records, is more appropriate than a 16K violation. No evidence that any of licensee's conduct caused harm or created any risk of harm to her clients. As we've noticed, there are just not standards for this kind of thing. The billing and timing questions raised in the IR have been explained, do not demonstrate any misconduct. Hindsight's always 20/20. Sitting here today, licensee realizes that she should have made other decisions. She's accepted responsibility for her decisions and her conduct. That is demonstrated by the 17 hours of relevant CEUs that she has taken. At the time, however, what is important for the board's determination is that her decisions were validly supported by a reasonable reading of the relevant statutes and regulations. So, evaluating reasonable defenses, we believe that the 16 YP and K violations should not be sustained because there is no clear and convincing evidence of those violations. The board deems it appropriate to act, and a non-disciplinary consent agreement or a letter of concern would be appropriate. It does not appear to be anything presently that requires remediation or monitoring, so we submit that if further education is required, the NDCA can take care of that. That's all I have to say, and Ms. Farmer is now available for questions. Thank you.
Farmer, did you want to add anything before we move to questions?
No.
Board members have questions?
I do. And Ms. Farmer? Can you kind of speak a little bit to your, I'm hearing that you're speaking to this critical decision-making model that you might have went through in your head, but what was your thoughts about having that with another colleague or consultation group or whatnot? I mean, you had this in here.
Yes. And now, I'm sorry, that seems obvious that that should happen now. Mm-hmm. At the time, I felt like I had done my research and felt comfortable with the decision. But today, I realize that consultation is absolutely essential and should have been done.
Okay. And I guess for me, this is somebody in an environment that you're employed by that didn't rise to a level of, wow, I really need to, if I'm even going to consider this, I really need to go outside of my comfort level here. Okay. And then you do mention in here that then you finally did staff with a clinical supervisor. Can you just tell me what the role of a clinical supervisor is in your world?
Yes, I was on another consent agreement at the time. I was not on the consent agreement when I began treatment. But then when the complaint arose, I met with her and discussed the situation.
Afterwards.
After the complaint.
Yeah, okay. So we had a clinical supervisor while we're currently on a consent agreement for issues, and we did not staff this case with your clinical supervisor at the time of making the decision or at the time of bringing on a clinical supervisor when you're supposed to staff all your cases?
She chose, let me rewind. So the cases we were focused on from the previous consent agreements were cases with minors and high conflict families. And so those were the cases that we staffed. She chose from the list randomly, which cases we stopped. She had a list of all my cases.
So during that time, you were pretty specific on what you wanted to present to your supervisor?
No, I wasn't specific. She had access to everything. We didn't go down the list necessarily one by one by one by one. She reviewed the notes and the cases, and then we discussed mostly the high conflict families. That was the focus of the first consent agreement.
Okay. But it wasn't a thought, though, that I have a clinical supervisor here. I'm also able to present things that I need clinical supervision on and direction on, and this would be a really integral part of using this clinical supervision.
Yeah. There were cases that I did bring to her attention when I did have questions outside of the cases that she chose. Uh-huh. But my thought at the time, which again in hindsight, was that my decision was sound, and so I didn't feel a need to point it out, this case.
Okay. And now today, as I'm seeing here, mentioned that this would have been the ideal person to talk this through the minute she got on your case and to clarify all the roles. Okay. I have a concern with a heavy focus on that we didn't have a personal relationship outside, and that's the reason that we're going to interpret dual relationship. Do you have different thoughts on what dual relationships mean?
Yes. Yes.
Can you just talk to me a little bit about where your thinking is on that?
First of all, to the multiple family members, that's a dual relationship that I had never considered. This is the first time I've treated multiple family members at one time. I took CPEs or CEUs about dual relationships, but dual relationships are also include, financial overlap, and I'm really not thinking clearly right now, but it's much deeper than professional and non-professional.
Okay.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Do you
feel now after you've taken your CEs and you had your consultations with your clinical supervisor? Was the feedback from those continuing education experiences and your clinical supervisor aligned that you should have done something differently?
Oh, God, yes.
So across the board in those trainings and from your clinical supervisor, they've observed that this is a practice standard.
Loud and clear.
Question.
Yeah.
Okay. You said your supervisor had access to your caseload. Was that supervisor aware that you were treating the medical director and the kids?
I did not bring it up to her specifically, so she wouldn't necessarily have recognized the name. She's not familiar with the practice, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's outside.
Outside. Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I guess I have another question. Just does it seem problematic that the client is signing kind of their own agency's forms to consent for treatment and the oversight as a parent and then also as a director of the agency with the kids' treatment? I mean,
yeah. It does today, yes.
Okay, and at the time, that did not seem strange that we would be signing our own agency forms and using our own employees for services?
I just didn't think that. I went through. It seems strange now.
Okay. And then just kind of lastly, I know if you can just speak a little bit to the idea that we, I did read, you know, that we had to check in the client into your EHR probably because of staffing issues or something, and then we have services well after. Is that common practice for this?
Our front office staff, her sessions were all at 5 o'clock, just to clarify. Our front office staff leaves anywhere between 4:30 and 5, so it's common for them to be gone. As therapists, we check them in, but if the sessions are running close, there are times I check them in after the fact when I'm going back in to prepare my notes. So the timestamp happens when we do the check-in process, so it's not necessarily when the session begins.
And then I know that we had some specifications this morning just about that you didn't document, you were only responsible for documenting behavioral health services, but behavioral health services include everybody who's participating in them. Do you feel differently about that?
I can see where that would be appropriate.
Okay, because just expecting everybody to correlate charts and all of that to know what's exactly going on and who's all there is unreasonable.
Right. Makes sense.
Okay.
I learned a lot about the whole collateral, documenting my role, you know, with each person, which I've changed to, but yes.
And then at any time did it feel concerning that we have a spouse who's also in the room, who's also administering treatment to another family member, and then also the parents of other family members, and also your employer?
It does now. With regard to the medical piece of administration, I assumed that they were following their board requirements. I didn't ask questions.
But that didn't seem concerning. Like, gosh, I should probably ask somebody this. As I just said that out loud, did that not feel so?
It feels
overlapped.
Concerning now.
Okay.
At the time, I didn't question it.
Okay.
Any additional questions from board members?
Sorry, I have one more. Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry. I know that just because it was mentioned this morning that you had already proactively taken some continuing ed, but I read them all, and yet 11 hours of CEU in one day. Does that not, I mean, as somebody else is reading that, my red flag goes up like, wow, were we speeding through all of these continuing? I can't comprehend, you know, 9 hours, barely 8. It just 11 feels just a little bit, I'm just saying, that's really alarming that we would take that much in one day and think we could actually really absorb and understand a lot of that critical information.
Yeah, I spread the reading out, but all the tests I took in one day, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Yeah, I printed off all the reading.
Okay.
And did my reading over a span of about a week.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took the tests all on one day.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, so I could see where that would look a little odd.
Thank you.
Any additional questions? This will be our time to talk amongst ourselves. We ask that you not interrupt.
Dr. Bailey?
Yeah. I think I have to be just forefront that upon reading all the material, I felt very uncomfortable with this case. We're on a current consent agreement, which was acknowledged, and that's the only reason when I saw the clinical supervisor, and then, you know, we can piece together why do we have clinical supervision at this time. And so we're currently on a consent agreement, been through this process, you know, in different ways, but any red flags should have been, you know, consulted with, not only outside people. This is so messy, and it feels so messy from the outsets, you know. This is somebody I'm working with. They're an employed by. They're the director. We've got another spouse included in this treatment. It's all being done after hours. The paperwork looks messy. It did not sit well. And today I very much appreciate the reflection and the insights that we're hearing today. So I just kind of wanted to be upfront with that on the record. I think there's clear and convincing evidence. I agree with the investigation that the violations took place. I think we're attesting to that this morning as well. So I would welcome any conversation about anything you might have saw or heard differently.
I just want to reiterate, as an independently licensed professional, to state that all of the training sent the same message to her, right? Like, there is a clear interpretation of our ethical obligations. And the training and the supervisor all sent the same message. And so to have not gotten that message at any point through graduate training and your associate period and now as an independent, is concerning. This isn't the first time you're hearing that. Would have been consistent training and continuing education. And so it's concerning that, like you said, in addition to not seeking the consultation because you're already on probation, but just to not have that clear understanding at this point in your career.
Yeah, I agree with that too. It seems like there's a lot of different times and situations where you could have gone, this is unusual, this doesn't feel good. It's not just the one thing, but, you know, like when your medical director asks you to treat them, to me that's like maybe one, it's like, what? No, and then there's a series of things. So, you know, that awareness of, this just feels different, right? Mm-hmm. I need to check with somebody. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I move that we find for the violations of 32, 32, 51, 16Y conflict of interest and 16K as it refers to the ACA Code of Ethics 8, multiple clients, as well as the document deficiencies, ARS 32, 32, 51, 16P, as it relates to 1101, 1103, and 1106.
Is there a second?
I think a second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Oppose? Motion carries.
And Madam Chair, if I can interrupt at this time, I know it was already alluded in the report by the client and her attorney. However, we do have a prior board action that has just now been uploaded to the member portal for your review. She entered into a consent agreement in February of 2021. She was released last month. There were three violations. One was failing to make client records available. The other was the termination of behavioral health services to a client without making an appropriate referral, as well as documentation issues for the consent to treat client record and telepractice. She was on probation for 12 months. During that 12 months, she was required to get clinical supervision. She was also required to take 3 clock hours addressing documentation, 6 hours of continuing education addressing high conflict families, as well as 6 hours in regards to addressing telehealth. They were all completed and she was released, but that is for your information, and that information can be considered when looking at the disciplinary action moving forward on this particular matter. And again, it has been uploaded to the portal if you'd like to further review it.
Just to clarify, I'm looking at this, an ethics class not included in that.
That is correct. Not included. As you guys are reading, I'm now having a huge difficulty sitting with that the focus of clinical supervision will relate to working with family cases. I don't know that, and I feel comfortable that this case was never staffed with her supervisor, and it's just a huge problem. Just as you're reading, if you guys want to look at that, see if you feel the same or different. I felt like we heard something a little different on a position on what the supervision was to be helpful for and focused, but here I think it's really clear that all family cases should have been staffed with a supervisor and reviewed ongoing, let alone what we might have learned already in the continuing ed. I don't know how much of that was completed by the time this behavior took place.
I would just think that that would have been another indicator not beforehand at this moment and with the staff at the end.
Meaning whenever that supervisor came on board, right, whatever time that was, that this is absolutely a case I need to tell you about. Since in my head I already went through this decision-making model, had to go through this decision-making model because it warranted that. It's also dealing with families, yet I'm still not going to talk to my supervisor about it. And that makes me think why.
And I would think that the staying out of trouble class would have addressed through our relationships
in the documentation.
In the documentation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So suggestions for moving forward to be there.
I really was waffled. I'll just give you my thought process. When I read all the investigation, I was like, I don't think this person deserves to be practicing. I'm fearful of what that looks like. If we're already on probation and we do this behavior, I'm heavily concerned on what we could do to be rehabilitated. And then I heard the clinician today, and then I was waffling, and I thought, okay. Maybe twice it gets, but then when I read what we have ordered and hoped would be helpful and it wasn't even accessed, I'm not sure, I don't feel comfortable having the licensee practice. But I am very open to if anybody hears that differently. I know I had a lot of time into really reading the details, so I might not be seeing something you all might be. Okay, I move that we ask for the surrender of the licensee's license. And there's other language that goes along with that that I do not recall. And if not, to assign the man to a formal hearing.
So moved. For a second. Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Mary Cunard.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobatz.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Polly Knapp.
Aye.
Adelaison Meek.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
I
I would like to additionally recommend that we pass this. I do not know what the medical codes are, their laws. I don't know any of that, but it feels like they needed to be able to determine that. So I would recommend that we pass this along to the medical board.
Do we need a motion for that? A motion to refer to the medical board? Is there a second?
Do we need to stay for this?
Dunnigan, second.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Knapp, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Dr. Bailey. And for the record, Ms. Palacios will join us. And we will go to agenda item 7F. Is the applicant present, Ms. Perry? We will hear a brief summary from board staff.
Madam Chair, members of the board, this matter is before you today just for the members to consider opening a complaint on Ms. Perry. As a courtesy, she was noticed that this would be presented to the board today. She's been licensed as an LMSW since May of 2019. She operates and owns her own private practice under the supervised private practice with an approved supervisor. On 2/4/22, applicant submitted her application for an LCSW. After review of the application, there were deficiencies noted. Board staff reached out to applicant to request further information, and on 6/21/22, applicant provided a response via clinical supervisor's email address. Applicant's application contained a verification of supervised work experience form and a verification of clinical supervision form signed by clinical supervisor on 6/20/22. On 6/29/22, due to continuing concerns, I emailed the clinical supervisor. Applicant responded to the executive director's communication indicating clinical supervisor forwarded her the email. Shortly after that, applicant called the executive director representing she found out that the clinical supervisor had passed away. I confirmed with the clinical supervisor's family that she had passed away on 6/13/22. It appears applicant signed and submitted forms on behalf of the clinical supervisor after she passed away. And again, that's before you to consider opening a complaint.
Any questions for Ms. Zavala? All right. Mr. Trotter?
Hello. I think the information we have learned today is cause for concern. So I motion that we open the complaint for the investigation.
Is there a second?
Knapp, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. 7D, Ms. Flowery, please come forward. Thank you. And we'll first hear a brief summary from board staff.
Madam Chair, members of the board, we're here today for the board members to consider possibly opening up a complaint in regards to after reviewing another board matter. Board staff found out that Ms. Lowry had been providing short-term disability documentation. That documentation Ms. Lowry has worked with the board and has provided us the documentation that she has submitted on behalf of clients. It appears to be out of her scope, and with that said, we'd like the board members to consider opening a complaint for board staff to further investigate, and that's all I have, unless you have questions for me.
Board members have any questions? Sorry, this is in front of us just in terms of opening a complaint, but you do have an opportunity if you'd like to address the board.
I would respectfully request that an investigation not be opened for myself, because completing short-term disability paperwork or not is a practice policy, and this issue is specifically named in a suggested investigation against Brian Zalamba. Opening a complaint against myself be redundant.
Board members have any questions? Thank you. Let's be our time to talk amongst ourselves.
If somebody has anything different, I would make a move that we open a complaint for further investigation.
Is there a second?
Yes, sir.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Board staff will be following up with you, Ms. Lowry.
That was
We need to get Mr. Barber on the Dr. Sponsor, if you would come forward, please. And for the record, this is 7H. And Mr. Barber, this is Patricia Dobratz again. We are getting ready to hear the matter for Dr. Salampa in regards to opening a complaint.
Yes.
All right. We'll first hear a brief summary from board staff.
Madam Chair, members of the board, this matter is before you today to consider whether or not you want to open up a complaint for further investigation. While investigating another matter, it was found that the licensee's private practice indicated there were 24 counselors employed by his practice. It appears that 13 of those counselors are not licensed by the board. It was unknown to board staff if any of the unlicensed counselors are contracted interns, but 7 only have a BA or a BS listed. We did do some research as well as a confirmation from our licensee and his attorney that it is not a licensed DHS agency. Additionally to that, it was also brought to our attention that FMLA, short-term disability, and ESA letters have been completed for clients of this agency. And that's all I have unless you have questions for me. And again, this is just for the members to consider whether they want to open up a complaint to investigate.
Do board members have any questions at this time? Mr. Barber, you and your client would have up to 5 minutes to address the board. Again, this is just before us in regards to opening the complaint.
Yes, nothing from me. One more time.
This will be a time to talk amongst ourselves. Mr. Charles?
Yeah, I think that what has been provided, there's a couple examples that did not appear the type of practice that we'd like to appear any exemptions, and because of that, I think we have to open an investigation. Maybe paperwork can clear this pretty easily, maybe not, but I think an investigation has to be. I move for that.
There a second.
That's a second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Mr. Barber, for being available. Thank you, Dr. Salampa, for being here.
Thank you, and thank you to the board and board staff.
Thank you. That will bring us to 7E, Mr. Medley. For the record, Mr. Medley is present. Good morning.
Good morning.
We'll first hear a brief summary from board staff.
Madam Chair, members of the board, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation, ARS 32-3251-16K, as it relates to the ACA Code of Ethics 1.1A, knowledge. Counselors know and understand the ACA Code of Ethics and other applicable ethics codes from professional organizations or certifications and licensing bodies of which they are members. This recommendation is based on the following. On 5-20-22, licensee emailed the board that he began supervising an LMSW in her own private practice without prior board approval. Licensee represented he made the mistake of forgetting about the approval process for private practice supervision. On 5-23-22, following a conversation with board staff, supervisee submitted a request for approval of clinical supervisor for supervised private practice. Licensee would not have been approved since he was an LPC and supervisee was an LMSW, and supervised private practice requires the supervisor be the same discipline as the supervisee. Licensee represented once supervisee contacted him, he only reviewed the board's rules around supervision and not the specific rules regarding supervised private practice. Licensee did not realize his mistake until months after beginning supervision of supervisee's private practice when a separate student came forward with questions which prompted licensee to look into various board's rules and statutes. Licensee acknowledges his oversight in violating board rules, but it was not malicious or intentional. Licensee further agrees as a supervisor he should have been more informed and reviewed rules and regulations more thoroughly. And that's all I have unless you have questions for me.
Thank you, Ms. Zavala. Do board members have any questions? Mr. Medley, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
I think Ms. Law's report there was pretty solid as far as what happened. It was a 100% oversight on my part. Ms. Taylor and I began, I don't know if I'm being heard well enough, when Ms. Taylor and I began discussions on whether or not, you know, I could supervise her, I went to the website, and when I went to the supervisor tab, I just clicked on supervision for social work and went through that as well as counseling. I completely failed to notice the tab of private practice supervision, and so that was 100% error on my part, and had I noticed that, I would have been able to click on it and very quickly seen, oh yeah, we need to find a different supervisor for her. When everything came about, I recommended a couple of LCSWs to Ms. Taylor that could work for her supervision, and the board was nice enough to push that through quickly last month so that she is under current approved supervision. But there was no malicious intent. Ms. Taylor and I did meet on a biweekly basis reviewing the cases she'd been going over and discussing things that could be done to better help her clients, also different, therapeutic approaches and things like that. It was a really bad mistake on my end where I missed a button I should have clicked on, and I missed some piece of information. And I was stepping outside of what I've normally done with supervision. I was like learning new things and trying out new things, and I stepped outside beyond where I should have been. Which is exactly why I brought the information to the board as soon as I noticed it. Like it was stated in Ms. Vala's statement, it was a student who came to me as an intern, looking to do an internship with me at my practice, and her discipline is in substance abuse, and that's what her education is in, what her master's is going to be in, and there's lots of variants and lots of differences there, and we had had a conversation during the interview if she'd be a good fit for my practice or not, and so I sent her back to her school counselor to talk about what the specifics are. I referred her also to a friend of mine who runs a place called Renaissance Recovery. It's a substance abuse place. I'm like, hey, that's probably a better fit for you because I know there's just differences. And then that was when I found my mistake and my oversight. And also the same day I brought it to the board, I made the first call there. So whatever your decision is as a board, I will honor that and respect it. And again, it's just there was no malicious intent. There was just a complete lapse on my part, a mistake on my part. And I do apologize for that. And I'm grateful for your time to hear that and to make the decision, whatever that may be.
Thank you. How many supervisees do you currently have, interns or associates?
Currently, I have only one. Yeah, I have one LAC working with me.
Do other board members have any other questions? This will be our time to talk amongst ourselves. We ask that you not interrupt.
Yes, so I appreciate Mr. Medley's statement and the information that we were provided supports the violation of stated. And any questions, any comments? I move to find the violation of
32, 3251. That pertains to ECA Code of Ethics, the I-1A knowledge?
Correct.
Is there a second? Bailey, second. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And now what we
do. So, based on the information and his statement, I think that I would like to discuss the CEUs. Do you have any legal issues? Like ethics, obviously. And maybe the also completing the tutorials from the board. But I'm open to. I'm sorry?
Like the staying out of trouble tutorial? Or?
I think the supervision.
No.
Oh, tutorial.
I'm sorry.
Sorry.
I would like to see, I think, and if you're open to this, is instead of the supervisor tutorial, I think retaking the 12-hour, which is kind of that initial supervisor training, versus just the 6 hours that you have to do every three years. the supervised private practice and these concerns that we're seeing is new territory for us because this is new. I appreciate Mr. Medley being transparent and coming forward and making his own report. The concerning part is, as supervisors, we're our first line for our supervisees, so regardless of what the nature is, we should be talking about our supervisees about thoroughly looking at everything that's required of you, right? And so you need to be modeling that. And so I'm happy that there isn't a large number of supervisees right now, I think, to kind of raise that his focus, but that just kind of concerns me. Your attention to detail is what we're modeling for our supervisees.
So are we offering a consent agreement for 12 months with that one educational item?
I mean, I don't think the ethics is bad, too, the $12 in the ethics course.
CEUs.
An agreement with educational components of ethics and the 12-hour supervision.
When you say ethics, are you speaking of the staying out of trouble or equivalent? Okay, I just told you. So what I'm hearing then, we would be offering a consent agreement for 12 months. He would be required to take 6 CEUs of staying out of trouble or equivalent, as well as the 12 hours of clinical supervision initial training. And if not signed, he'd be invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remanded to a formal hearing.
I have a question, though, too. Usually on a consent agreement, they can't provide supervision, correct?
That would be correct. Clinical supervision towards hours.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, again, it is a 12-month CA, but oftentimes when people are just stipulated to get education, it's often done within a month or two, so that would be up to Mr. Medley on how quickly he wanted to complete that.
Just a question.
Supervisee.
If he's supervising somebody for hours towards independent level licensure, those hours would not count while on the CA, correct?
They had another clinical supervisor.
That is correct.
Would he be eligible for early release?
Yes, as soon as the education is done, he can request release.
If it's just education.
And typically people do it pretty quick just so they can get released. Yeah.
And if my colleagues see this the way I see it, could his 12-hour supervision course count toward licensing, renewal?
No, not in any case. Do any hours in CEUs for discipline count towards your clinical supervision education or for your renewal education? It would be in addition to.
Would it count as his next renewal, so his supervision would then be the next renewal?
It would not. It's basically in addition to any requirements educationally that would have to be completed.
Anything else? Ms. Zavala, could you read?
Yes, we'd be offering a consent agreement, and he would be for 12 months. And within that 12 months, he would be required to take 6 CEUs in staying out of trouble or the equivalent, as well as 12 hours of the initial clinical supervision training. And once he completes all that, he can ask for release. If not signed, he'd be invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, he'd be remanded to a formal hearing.
I move to approve.
Second, Trotter.
Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Mary Cunard.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobratz.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Polly Knapp.
Aye.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Motion carries. Thank you, Ms. Yes.
May I ask one question? Just a clarifier for my supervisee. I was stated that the hours at this time won't apply towards his licensure when he does apply down the road. Is there something else that I should do in order to? I mean, continuing supervising him is the correct path. I'm understanding that, and these hours aren't going to count, which is understandable. Is there anything else that I should do with my current supervisee just to make sure that everything that is involved with the consent here works and nothing else goes sideways that I'm not aware of at this point, because I've never been in this position before?
Well,
I mean, you can call me, we can discuss it on Monday, but no, I mean, basically, once this is executed by myself, mm-hmm. from the time it's executed to the time you're released by the board, any hours you provide clinical supervision can't be counted towards independent level licensure. Mm-hmm. I think you need to be very transparent with who you're supervising so that they're aware of that, because that would be an option that could go outside of your agency if that worked.
Yeah, he's very aware of this situation as well. Mm-hmm.
But you're welcome to call me, though, if you would like.
Thank you very much, Ms. Vaughn.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll go to 7J. In my understanding, it's Ms. Taylor's case. My understanding is Ms. Knapp needs to recuse from this matter. And Ms. Taylor is coming forward. Good morning.
Good morning.
First, here, a brief summary from board staff.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board, I won't read the analysis on this particular matter because Mr. Medley was Ms. Taylor's supervisor. I'm just going to read you the violations that board staff is recommending based on the fact that she was providing services without, in a sense, being properly supervised. The violations will be AOS 32-3251-16II, violating any federal or state law, rule, or regulation applicable to the practice of behavioral health as it relates to R46210, practice limitations, as well as R46211, direct supervision. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Do board members have any questions? You would have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Sure, thank you. So I submitted a letter to all of you, so I'm not to repeat everything I've already said and what Mr. Mendez has already said, but I'm new to the clinical world. I think the biggest mistake I made was relying on my supervisor to know what was required, and I should have taken the responsibility and looked into that. I had just assumed that the supervision that was required was, I didn't realize that there were separate requirements for a private practice. So I made the mistake of not looking into that myself and relying on the supervisor to have that information. And then beyond that, he helped me find a new supervisor, submitted for that, so I now have an approved supervisor, and then I also got a message that because they changed some of the requirements, we have to reapply. So I just met with my supervisor yesterday, and she handed me that paperwork, so I submitted that to the board this morning with the new application. So everything is on the right track now.
Thank you. Taylor, did you realize that supervised private practice was relatively new in Arizona?
I did not. I'm new to the clinical world, so I work in school, and I started working in private practice last August, so I did not realize that was new.
Opening your own practice as an associate is a big undertaking. What did you do to become informed about how to go about that and board rules? And can you walk us through your process before you found a supervisor even?
Yes. Well, so I was in an agency. I started in an agency last August. And then I had talked to a couple colleagues who are LCSWs, but granted, they're LCSWs, so they're not associate level. And we had talked about, I knew that you could do private practice as long as you were under supervision. Again, nobody in those conversations, I didn't gather from them that there was different requirements than what you would normally do in a supervision situation. So I didn't go to the board site myself and look into that information. I had just talked to people. And so again, that's the biggest mistake I made. And then reaching out to the supervisor, I had asked him questions, again, just assuming that he would have that information.
Thank you. Do board members, other board members have questions? This will be our time to talk amongst ourselves. We ask that you not interrupt.
Yes, so this is the other part of the previous case, and I appreciate Ms. Taylor's statement. It is based on the information that we read and their statement, it is supportive of the violation of 32-3251 II, practice limitation supervision. So anybody has any comments? So I move to find the violation of
32, 32, 51.
Is there
a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
So I'm supporting a consent agreement for 12 months as well with 6-hour ethics class and staying out of trouble.
Ms. Zavala, can you talk to the idea of being on a consent agreement while we're in private practice as an associate?
It's not prohibited.
Okay.
Any other comments, suggestions?
The purpose of the ethics course.
Okay, so the practice limitations might be addressed there.
I think when I think you used the word course, but do you mean CEUs?
CEUs, yes. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
CEUs, not college level course.
Just for the sake of conversation, I don't want to drag it out. But again, this is new territory for us. I'm usually the school supervisor more accountable. In these ones, I have a really tough time with somebody jumping into such a huge endeavor without knowing the rules. But I don't know what the remedy is for that. And so I think a little bit of conversation about that. I think that staying out of trouble course is a good course, but just
is it more?
No, I don't know. and it is new territory for us. Maybe it's just for the sake of the record, but if you're going to do something, if you are an associate opening a private practice, if you're anybody opening a private practice, you need to cross your T's and dot your I's. And you're a licensed professional, which means seeking out what applies to that process. And I appreciate the transparency, but I just can't stress that enough. It's really concerning what we're seeing.
A quick question to professional members. So I'm assuming because this practice is so new, there's no real training specifically tailored towards supervised private practice.
No.
Yet, at least, correct?
Some supervisor trainings are incorporating it. Some ethics trainings are incorporating it, but it's new and not all of them do.
You know, some supervision trainings, like the 12 hours, I personally think that they should not be exclusive for supervisors. Right? I think that it could be very beneficial for supervisees because honestly, you learn about everything there.
And I don't think there's anything that would prohibit.
Also, there are some people who give trainings on opening a private practice and all that goes into that. And so that may be something that we can request as well as take that training. And even maybe as a board, talk about that for people who are opening private practice to make that a piece of it, just because there's so many elements that go to it.
Yeah, because it's business. It's
correct.
It's a business thing you need to... you know, be able to follow, and, you know, when we go to school, we're not taught those things.
Correct.
It's business, it's licensing, it's insurance, it's working at a brick and mortar, it's also liability insurance for the brick and mortar. So there's so many elements that...
Social media, you know.
Mm-hmm. We're just up at the precipice of it, and so they can stumble easily.
What if we did the staying out of trouble rate for them, and then a 3-hour in opening a private practice? I mean, there's multiple of those available now.
I like it, personally.
Madam Chair, may I adjust for the record Mr. Trotter's question in regards to the training? Because I think it's really important. One, in our new rules, we are going to include the supervised private practice portion of it, so anybody that's providing clinical supervision is going to understand. But I think just more importantly, it's really important for me to say this, there should not be one associate-level licensee out there that knows that they cannot open up their own private practice. So even though there's not training, that's what they get trained. That's what they go to school for. So I don't think there was any ill intent, but you just needed to call the board and ask a simple question. Or ask, you know, and I appreciate the clinical supervisor taking responsibility, but I tell my staff all the time, it's you own that application, you own that license. It's up to you to know those rules. And the importance of a two-tier licensureship is huge. So, and I just feel very strongly, so I had to say that.
It's a good discussion, like I said, as it's new for us. Mm-hmm. You want to read back what?
So I'm reading, though, I think the when I heard that I didn't go to the board website and didn't read the rules, I'm just leaning into doing the board tutorials for supervision and the board rules.
They're great, yeah.
They're well done. They are, it's all of them. So it would be a chance, you know, to thoroughly go over those. It would also include, and I'm not saying that to preclude anything anybody has said today, but I think those two resources are really valuable right now to really make sure that those are well understood, and then they'll be reviewed again when she gets licensed and has to go through it again.
Absolutely.
I
agree with that.
So we would be offering a consent agreement for 12 months. She would be required to take 6 contact hours of staying out of trouble or equivalent, as well as 6 continuing educations on opening up a private practice. As well, she'd be required to take the clinical supervision tutorial. In addition to that, the renewal tutorial. If not signed, she would be invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remanded to a formal hearing.
I think the opening private practice ones tend to be 3 hours. I don't know if anybody knows any different, but I think that would probably be appropriate. If it's longer, great, but...
Okay, so the 3 CEUs in opening a private practice.
An opportunity for early release?
Yeah, education. As soon as it's completed, she can request early release.
So I move to approve.
Is there a second?
That's your second.
Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Mary Kuna.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Delvaux.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Adelaide Samik.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Motion carries. Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Best of luck to you.
Thank you. Will you guys be sending that to me?
Okay. For example, reach out and have it all outlined for you.
All right. Thank you.
Let's take a break. It is 11:48. Let's come back at 11. Let's come back to order. It is 11:55. We're going to go to agenda item number 7A. Ms. Cheatham, is the complainant present for that matter? If you want to come forward. And for confidentiality purposes, we'll refer to you by your initials, JW. Is that correct?
That's fine. Yeah.
And is the licensee present?
Yeah.
All right. We'll first hear a brief summary from board staff.
Madam Chair, members of the board, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violations. ARS 32-3251-16L, engaging in any conduct, practice, or condition that impairs the ability of a licensee to safely and competently practice the licensee's profession. Also, ARS 32-3251-16K, engaging in any conduct or practice that is contrary to recognized standards of ethics in the behavioral health profession, or that constitutes a danger to the health, welfare, or safety of a client as it relates to the following sections of the ACA Code of Ethics. A6D, role changes in the professional relationship, and A8, multiple clients. This recommendation is based on the following. From 10/19 to 3/21, licensee provided marital counseling services to complainant and wife. Since 3/21, licensee has been providing individual counseling services to wife. At the onset of treatment, licensee had wife and complainant each sign their own informed consents, identifying themselves as clients. In couples or marital counseling, the couple is considered the client rather than an individual person. Despite the 10/4/19 initial appointment session indicating the focus of counseling would be to help the couple, around 2/21, licensee began seeing wife individually and continues to see wife presently on an individual basis. It is concerning the records did not contain a treatment plan and the informed consent did not specifically outline the purpose of the counseling, therefore not clearly defining wife, complainant, and licensee's role in the therapy. While couple sessions were occurring, wife was simultaneously meeting with licensee individually. Around 3/21, licensee referred complainant and wife to a sex therapist to help with their issues within the marriage. Licensee subsequently continued treatment
treating wife individually since 3/21. In 6/21, complainant emailed licensee asking to schedule a session with licensee. The licensee responded it would be a conflict of interest to meet with complainant. It is highly concerning that licensee represents it would have been a conflict of interest to meet with complainant, but it was not a conflict of interest to meet with wife. Furthermore, on 9/10/21, complainant emailed licensee staff and indicated he felt it was a conflict of interest by licensee providing individual counseling services to wife, yet licensee continued to treat wife for several months. Licensee represented the following during an investigative interview. Licensee knew complainant, had his own individual therapist already. Wife was now licensee's client, and licensee could not meet with complainant. Licensee held individual sessions with wife while couples counseling was taking place because she felt it would be beneficial to the relationship. When licensee started individual sessions with wife during the course of marital counseling, complainant never expressed concerns at that time. Licensee understands she should have had wife sign a new informed consent, and that the informed consent complainant and wife signed did not specifically discuss how marriage counseling would work. Licensee failed to obtain a new and updated informed consent from wife once she transitioned solely to individual counseling and failed to document in a progress note wife's transition in roles. It is a counselor's responsibility to clearly define each participant's role in the therapeutic process, and licensee failed to define such roles. Following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violations. ARS 32-3251-16L, engaging in any conduct, practice, or condition that impairs the ability of licensee to safely and competently practice their profession, and ARS 32-3251-16P, failing to conform to minimum practice standards as developed by the board as it relates to consent for treatment, treatment plan, telepractice. This recommendation is based on the following. From 10/19 to 3/21, licensee provided marital counseling services to complainant and wife, and since 3/21, licensee has been providing individual counseling to wife. On 9/24/19, wife signed an informed consent for counseling services, and on 10/4/19, complainant signed an informed consent for counseling services. Both of these informed consents were missing a minimum board requirement, as well as all minimum telehealth requirements. Despite licensee transitioning from couples to individual counseling with wife, licensee failed to update wife's informed consent documents. Furthermore, licensee failed to generate any treatment plan for complainant and wife during the course of couples counseling or for wife once she began individual counseling. Numerous progress notes within complainant and wife's records indicated telehealth services, but several of the progress notes failed to include various telehealth requirements. It is highly concerning that licensee failed to develop a treatment plan for complainant and wife despite treating them for roughly 17 months. Further concerning is that licensee transitioned to individual services with wife for the past year and again failed to develop any treatment plan. Furthermore, once wife transitioned from couples to individual, it appears the goals of therapy shifted to new goals, but this could not be measured or identified due to licensee not developing any treatment plan or having wife sign her own informed consent outlining the purpose of treatment. During an investigative interview, licensee represented she knew formal treatment plans needed to be developed. It's concerning that licensee represents she knew treatment plans are a requirement, yet failed to create any sort of treatment plan over the last 2.5 years with either complainant or wife. Further concerning is that licensee has been in private practice for roughly 15 years and does not complete the required documentation for her clients. Furthermore, licensee has renewed her license with the board 7 times since being in private practice, and a requirement of the license renewal process is to review the board's rules and statutes, which covers documentation standards. Additionally, following the review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16KK, failing to make client records and licensee's possession promptly available to the client, a minor's client's parent, the client's legal guardian, or the client's authorized representative upon receipt of proper authorization to do so from the client. This recommendation is based on the following. From 10/19 to 3/21, licensee provided marital counseling services to complainant and wife. On 10/4/19, complainant signed an informed consent for services. On 9/23/21, complainant emailed licensee requesting the progress notes from his couple sessions. On 9/30/21, licensee drafted a letter addressed to complainant indicating she received his request for records and would be seeking legal consultation before releasing the records. Despite licensee providing board staff with a screenshot of complainant accessing the client portal up to May of 21, showing he had access to the records, licensee never provided complainant with copies of his records. Furthermore, licensee reports seeking legal consultation but has no written evidence of any sort of legal advice regarding the records request. Licensee represents based on a consultation with an attorney and other professionals. She was told she could only release records if wife consented to the release of records, so licensee only released the informed consent complainant completed, but no session notes. It is highly concerning that licensee began treating complainant and wife for couples counseling, and when complainant formally requested his couples sessions notes, licensee denied complainant access to the records he had a legal right to. And that's all I have, unless you have anything, any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carver. Are there any questions? As the complainant, you have up to 7 months to address the board.
Thank you. I guess I'll start off by just saying thank you to the board for opening the case and doing the investigation. I really appreciate it. I do also want to say, you know, I don't mean any ill will towards Mrs. Cheatham by opening the complaint. This is my first time undergoing any sort of counseling, so I was very new to it. In hindsight, maybe a little naive, I didn't do as much research as I probably could have, investigate her qualifications and her methods of doing practice and comparing those to others in the industry. But, you know, I learned a lot from it. If I could go back, I would definitely do those things, do my own research. Again, I don't hold any ill will towards Ms. Cheatham, but I do think she made some errors in judgment in counseling my wife and I, undergoing our counseling sessions without having a treatment plan in place. I think that was really a detrimental thing for us. We didn't have any set goals or direction. We underwent counseling for a very long period of time. I felt like we maybe didn't make as much progress as we could have if we had done things a little differently, and I'm certain my wife felt the same way. Unfortunately, I think those feelings of frustration and lack of progress probably contributed to us ultimately getting a divorce, and I'm sad for that because I feel like maybe with different guidance we would have had an opportunity to be a little bit more successful in our marriage. Again, bringing the case here, my intent is to offer an opportunity for any corrections in Ms. Cheatham's practice if there needs to be. And not necessarily for myself because I can't change anything that's happened in my situation, but potentially for any couples or individuals who might be seeing her in the future. And then I guess the only thing I'll touch on is just the emotions that I, you know, went through during this whole situation, particularly when I was told that my wife was going to file for divorce. You know, we had been seeing Celeste for couples counseling for a very long period of time. She knew both of us intimately and our marital situation. I did ultimately get my own counselor for depression and anxiety for that type of treatment. However, he did not have access to the history that Celeste did, the knowledge of everything that had gone on while we were seeing her. And, you know, I attempted to get the records of our counseling released to him so that he could review them and we could talk about some of the things that had happened. I was not successful at that, obviously, and so there's a lot of frustration, a lot of anger, a lot of confusion, not only from that perspective, but from the perspective that my wife could continue to see Ms. Cheatham, and I couldn't. And it was just a very emotional time for me. Ultimately, I've, you know, come to peace with it. I've been moving on, but again, I ultimately don't want someone else to have to go through what I had to go through. So, you know, I just want to say thank you again.
Thank you. Do you board members have any questions? Thank you for being here. I ask you to take your seat. Ms. Cheatham, you can come forward, please. And you have up to 7 minutes to address the board now.
Okay, thank you. I hope you can hear me. I'm going to keep my mask on because I'm recovering from something. I want to start by first acknowledging that I did not
practice to a standard of excellence as one would expect someone who has been in my role and has renewed my license as many times as I have. I acknowledge that I did not handle things correctly. There was some administrative things that slipped through the cracks, and obviously all the details are in the reports that you have, so I'm not going to go over them, but I will say that, first of all, I take very seriously my role as a counselor, and it's heartbreaking for me to hear that someone feels that I had something, you know, really personally to do with them not being able to continue in their marriage. I am as hopeful as any couple when I enter into that process with them that it's going to be successful. In this particular case, in the documentation that I did see the wife a couple of times, each time was during the course of couples work, and each of those times was because it felt like there was a specific individual issue that can be handled. I can give her a little bit more support, and then we can get back to addressing the issues that they are dealing with within the relationship. When it became clear that there were some really specific issues that were beyond my scope of training, I did make the appropriate referrals. I gave them multiple options and said, if for some reason you don't like any of those, please let me know. I will give you additional referrals. When we transitioned to doing individual work, there was a lapse, and that is part of the administrative part that I did lapse on, and I've since come to understand after my interview with the board that I needed to completely close that out, be done with it, open up a brand new file, which I have made those adjustments and document the relationship between the two files in that. In terms of the decisions that I made, there was never a malicious intent of I was on her side or I was on his side about this. What ended up happening was at the point when I referred them out and the three of us talked about, you know, what are we going to do? How are we going to proceed? I'm going to spin you out. This person is going to take over your couple's work. The wife asked if she could continue to work with me because she felt that she did not want to kind of go over some of her trauma history again with someone new. I'm very sensitive to that, and so I said, of course. At the time, he already had an individual counselor that he had expressed really liking and feeling comfortable with, and so that was the thought behind that clinical decision to keep her on as a client. I can now see in hindsight that that left it open for things to become very messy, and so I take accountability for that and not handling it. When he reached out to me in May, it was he wanted to discuss the issues at that point. She had asked for the divorce. This is all becoming very messy at this point. And so that is when I said, I cannot meet with you individually. And it was also with the knowledge that the wife had met with him and his individual counselor to clearly explain what her thoughts and reasonings were for it. So I felt like his therapist had the information that was helpful, but you know, all of that went into my decision. So it wasn't that, okay, here I'm saying, yes, I will work with the wife as well as him. And over here, it's, no, I will not let you have any access to me. It was that things were shifting. There was court involvement. She had made some allegations that I was very mindful of. Perhaps I was no longer able of giving him the open, safe, objective space that I believe he deserved. And so I say all that to say that I did not make the best decisions along the way. I can see the error in the ways that I handled things. I did respond to his letter, unfortunately, what ended up happening, and I believe this is all in the report as well, was I handed it off, I wrote the letter, signed it, handed it off to my administrative assistant. It never got sent. I understand it is my practice, it is my responsibility to make sure and follow up with her. But in complete candidness, I was also packing up my house and I had nowhere to go. So I was spending every moment of my time trying to figure out where I was going to be living. So things fell through the cracks. And it's not acceptable from a professional standard. I understand that. I take responsibility for the ways that I have not lived up to the standard of excellence that I should be practicing.
Thank you. Board members have questions? I have a couple questions, Mrs. Cheatham. Thank you. I guess if you could kind of just help me understand, it feels like the complainant just he needed you know some forms, and I help me understand why we just didn't send them to him. You know, why don't we just kind of help him with some of the requests that he had, you know, so that we could just even acknowledge just, you know, what his needs at that time.
Absolutely. After I talked with, after I received his communication requesting the records, they were at a point where things were very messy legally in terms of their divorce. I was uncertain as to what the intention was behind wanting these records around them. I understand they are his. I reached out to my malpractice insurance. They connected me with someone to do a consultation with. At the consultation, she said, if the wife does not give consent, you cannot release. Had she told me something different, I would have done something different. I have no legal background. I leaned on this consultation to give me what is appropriate. Now, I did staff with several other colleagues across multiple disciplines, psychologists, MFTs, LMFWs, and the consensus seemed to be from everyone that it's without her consent, you cannot release it, or if you do release it, it's heavily redacted. So that was my understanding. So going into the consult, so when the attorney told me, no, you can't release that, you do not have her consent,
Sure. Then
that's what I leaned on. There was no reason behind it other than just trying to do what I was advised from someone that I believed was giving me sound legal advice.
But we didn't document it, correct? So we went through kind of all that, you know, to help you decide, but then we just don't document any of it.
Right.
So just something, did you ever think to document that so that you could, you know, show all of that due diligence to try to find out?
No, I did not.
Would you know?
Of course.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And then just kind of curious, it sounds like you did a lot of consultation, but did you also look at your code of ethics?
As far as
client access?
Yes, and I saw that it had it, but what I was running into I wasn't sure about was, if there's a wife, there's a husband, she's saying, I absolutely do not want my records released.
He's saying,
I absolutely do want these. And so that's where I wasn't sure. I understand clients have a right to the records. That, there's no dispute about it, not at all.
Yeah, a lot of gray area. I'm not contesting that or questioning that. Your code, though, is kind of clear. As far as, when it says, in situations involving multiple clients, counselors provide individual clients with only those parts of the record that relate directly to them and do not include confidential information related to the other client.
Okay.
That might have helped.
So it should have been heavily redacted then.
Mm-hmm. And that's what the code reads. That's how it sounds to me. But again, then, if you had gone through all that consultation, it would have been helpful to document that, just so that
I understand.
But I was also just kind of including, he also just wanted the consent forms. That was really the origination of my question,
yes.
Which is okay. He just kind of wanted copies of the forms. Yeah, we also just didn't really bother to send him those.
I apologize. I thought I did. That was also sent the same day that I thought my receptionist had sent. I drafted a letter, and I gave him the copies of the consents that were initially signed. So I thought it had gone out to him. I honestly did not realize that the email did not go out until after I had sat with my interview for the board. I had no idea. I never went back and looked at it. I just
had a lot of personal stuff going on at that time, and it fell through the cracks. So I sincerely apologize, because even as I was interviewing with the interviewers, I was under the belief that, no, I did provide what I could provide, and I did not provide the parts that I could not. So I didn't realize that what I was saying was not accurate in my interview.
Thank you. I hear you say that at the time that this was happening, that you also had a lot going on. And my question is, are you doing anything for your own self-care? Because as therapists, obviously, sometimes what we ignore can spill over or impact our treatment. So are you doing anything for self-care for you so you can stay on top of these other...
Yes, I have an individual therapist. I see her twice a month for sessions. I'm a voracious reader, and I listen to a lot of podcasts, and it's just been a tremendously difficult season. After this, I'm leaving to go spread my father's ashes. I mean, I'm trying my best to keep everything on the rails the best I can. And I am sincerely sorry that I allowed my personal, you know, issues to impact the way that I practice. You know, I acknowledge my client deserved better. They both did, both him and her, and I am sincerely sorry about his experience with my practice. I would not want anyone to leave my practice worse off than when they walked in the door. I do not look lightly on the responsibility that I have to the people I work with.
And then one more follow-up question. Do you have some formal training in working with couples work? I know that's not necessarily in your curriculum. You've been in practice for a long time, so I'm just kind of curious.
Yes, I understand. And actually, when I read the report that was written, I think we didn't accurately convey the training that I did have. So as I'm like under some very, I went through a very long time ago. I know the statutes have changed a lot since then. So I didn't receive any as part of my formal undergraduate training. However, I received training. It's usually in, you know, the form of like one-day seminars where you go. I've done several over the years. I've done the Prepare and Enrich curriculum. I am doing the... I have the goal of going through the EFT and formally getting certified. It's kind of a issue of resources. It's a very expensive process to go through, but there are some places that have opened up scholarships that I've been able to take advantage of. So a lot of it has been self-study just because of limited resources and inability to attend trainings that are longer than one day.
Sure. And do you feel like, now that we're reflecting back on some of the missteps, do you feel like there was information on role changes and how to address that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There were things that should have been done differently, I could have done differently. I think that if I am completely, you know, looking back on this through eyes of what could I have done differently, there were some moves that I should have made. Perhaps she should have had her own individual counselor in the beginning that I should not have even tried, even if I just thought, like, well, it's just one session and then we can get back on track. But I probably should have kept those a little bit cleaner. I have been in practice a while. This is the profession I've chosen. All my eggs are in this basket. I want to do whatever I can do to get back to a place of good standing and make sure that I am practicing with excellence.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. Any additional questions? Right, this will be our time to talk amongst ourselves. We ask that you not interrupt.
I think in light of kind of just a lot of our questions and the investigation and the client or the licensee here today kind of just walking us through everything, I think we have clear and convincing evidence for the violations. Is there, before I just go forward, is there anyone who is feeling alternative to that or contrary to that? We can see that? Okay. And I really appreciate the comments today and the accountability today by the licensee.
I think that helps with the rest of where we're going with this. But I would find in violation 32, 3251, 16L, engaging in conduct or practice that impairs the ability of licensee to safely, confidently practice. And 16, 32, 3251, 16K, as it relates to the ACA Code of Ethics, A6D and A8. And then I would also find for the violation of 32, 3251, 16P, as it relates to documentation 1101, 1102, and 1106. And then I would find for the failure to release records, 32, 3251, 16KK. But I would like to specify, and I'm very open to just anybody else's comments contrary to this, I like to specify as it relates to the ACA Code of Ethics, B6E.
Just for clarification, Dr. Bailey, instead of doing the KK, you would prefer to do the K as it relates to the ACA Code of Ethics?
I would.
Okay. And maybe I missed this. There was one other in the analysis, 32, 3251, 16L. Did I just miss
it? It just feels like that was redundant. I didn't.
It was redundant, but it was for different findings of facts, but in the consent agreement, it only would be listed okay. Once.
Yeah, I just didn't repeat it. I thought it was. No worries.
Is there a second? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
I'm comfortable. I think we could in safely offering a consent agreement. I think we could do some continuing ed indoor relationships, multiple clients. I think we could do some formal CEUs. It sounds like we have some going, but we can memorialize it with couples work. I think documentation, six, you know, staying out of trouble or the equivalent would be fine. Maybe a 16 in ethics, not a graduate class, but I think just kind of an ethics refresher would be good. I'd be open to anything else you guys might think would be helpful.
I appreciated Dr. Hennigan's questions regarding self-care because I had made a note that came up a couple times, and I'm not sure we need to add that to the consent agreement, but I just think for conversation, continue to do that.
In any areas of focus the licensee should be focused on in her self-care? Which
I think she's...
So she's doing it already?
Okay. She's got insight to that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Just for clarification, Dr. Bailey, is that three CEUs in dual relationship, three CEUs in multiple clients, and then the six staying out of trouble? You want those separated?
Do six with both of those, sorry. They're going to be covered probably together.
Okay. So we would be offering the licensee consent agreement for 12 months. She would be required to take six CEUs in dual relationships, six CEUs in multiple clients, as well as six CEUs in staying out of trouble or the equivalent, and six CEUs in behavioral health ethics. And if not signed, she'd be invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remand to a formal hearing.
And the multiple clients refers to couples. Is that what you were referring to?
Yeah, I just figured with multiple parties in the room how to handle that.
I just want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So moved.
Is there a second?
And are you ready?
Yes, when she finishes the education.
Okay. Okay. Yes.
Second. Okay. Roll call, please.
Who's seconding?
Sorry. Ms. Meek.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Robert Charles. Mary Cunan.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobatz.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Polly Knapp.
Aye.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Okay. Board will be following up with you and outlining all of this. Best of luck to you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Go to 7I, Mariana Tadamy. The complainant, Mr. Messer, is not present. In the interest of transparency, I just want to state for the record, I did work at the entity involved in this complaint. I was not there at the time of the incident. I do know the licensee and the complainant, but not to the degree that would cause a conflict or a bias, but I just want to put that on the record, and I was not there at the time of the incident. So we'll hear a brief summary from board staff.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the board, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 3232516S, terminating behavioral health services to a client without making an appropriate referral for continuation of care for the client if continuing behavioral health services are indicated. This recommendation is based on the following. From 321 to 921, licensee was employed at agency as a therapist. Licensee's personnel records included several conversations during clinical supervision around meeting the goal of seeing 25 clients per week. On 9/24/21, around 2 p.m., licensee submitted her resignation, with 9/24/21 being her last day, with only a few hours notice of her resignation. Licensee was instructed to contact her clients and notify them of her departure and assist with the transition to another therapist. According to licensee's personnel records, which included a spreadsheet of her caseload, licensee had 42 active clients, and there was no record of her contacting 19 of those clients regarding her departure. In her written response to the complaint, licensee reported there was only 5 to 7 clients she did not speak to but left very detailed voicemails for regarding her departure. Licensee represented the following during an investigative interview with the board staff. Licensee had only 11 to 15 consistent clients that would attend therapy, and the rest were inconsistent. It is incorrect that the agency represents she did not get in contact with 19 of her clients from her caseload. Licensee left voicemails for clients who did not answer. Licensee was working from home on an agency laptop and was locked out of the system before she could enter all of her notes. Licensee feels clients get abandoned by agencies when they abruptly terminate employees. Licensee agreed she did not apply the ACA Code of Ethics when departing agency by abruptly resigning. It is concerning that rather taking accountability, licensee appeared to shift the blame that she felt it was appropriate to resign effective immediately because it would be the same as if the agency terminated an employee effective immediately. Licensee resigned effective immediately with minimal notice to agency for clients without ensuring continuity of care was in place for all of her clients. And that's all I have unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you, Ms. Fala. Do board members have any questions? You have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Sure, thank you. Hi, everyone. So, yes, I was working from home. The laptop was the agency's, and so when I submitted my resignation, I was locked out, and that was the reason for not being able to submit all my documentation. I don't understand why he's saying I didn't reach out to 19 clients. I reached out to everyone on that list. The only thing that I was not able to do was document everything because I was locked out. And that's really all I have to say.
When did you accept the position at La Frontera?
I don't know the exact date that I accepted the offer, but I started working on October the 11th of last year.
Had you accepted the offer before you put your notice in?
No.
So you didn't have another position when you...
No, not that I remember.
Can I ask why not give the time to coordinate a transfer?
Sure. Because I was going through a divorce at the time, and the pay checks that I was receiving were really minimal. I needed a better paying job so that I could afford that, and also I was under the care of my girls, so I couldn't continue just with this agency that wasn't paying enough.
I understand the reason for resigning, but giving a couple days, if you didn't have something else that was going to be income, a couple days to transition your clients and prepare for that.
Oh, absolutely. So a lot of the clients that I was assigned to were not attending. A lot of them would schedule and would not show up for sessions. So, yeah, that was one of my main reasons. It was a lot of inconsistency with the clients.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I wonder about the issue of being locked out of the system, and I wonder, would that have allowed you to perhaps document something and provide it for the agency that they could then perhaps subsequently enter into their system? But you would demonstrate your diligence by documenting it.
sorry, I didn't think about that. I just knew that at that point I was locked out, and because it was a work from home position, I didn't really have anybody else that I felt like I could really reach out to at that point.
I have a question about one of the statements surrounding comparing meeting with clients, you know, when someone is, you know, fired from the agency or that being the same as your situation. Can you speak a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I when I made that statement, it wasn't me trying to shift blame and trying to not take accountability for what I did. I understand that it is important that we do terminate appropriately. At that point, when I made that decision, there was a lot of emotions involved, and I was just trying to figure things out.
This will be our time to talk amongst ourselves. We have to not interrupt. Ms. Knapp, I believe this was yours.
Yeah, this one was mine. And, you know, I'm struggling, so I'm hoping that... I think on the one hand, when we say, you know, clear and convincing evidence, how about we have that in this case? Because we have opposing viewpoints where she says she did make the call for them, for them brutal, and for them in this week, not to walk her out. I really appreciate, you know, what you said, Doc, about what you've documented that snow in some other way and got it over to the organization. So I think that is a factor.
And I didn't ask if there was a supervisor involved, because even though it's a work-from-home situation, which I've had, I had a supervisor, and I had a phone number for my supervisor, and I could have done, I could have accomplished any communication needed with that supervisor, never having walked into the office.
Right, and I think that's a factor as well. So I think we have some conflicting stuff with, you know, her report of making the effort. Did that happen? No documentation of that. I think there's also some concerns with the client's verbiage just surrounding that the thing when someone is let go from the organization. I think that part of 20,000 organization. Hopefully it's kind of effective in school, and so then they can step in and referrals and reach out to those clients, right? So there's sort of a safety net there for those clients. If the professional onus is on her as a licensed, if, you know, someone with a license, then she has to treat people well. That would be
questions. And I appreciate... Sorry, Madam Chair, members of the board. I appreciated the sentiment around serving clients who come don't adhere to whatever the schedule is, and I acknowledge I don't like that, because if I'm there, I'd like somebody to come in and see me if that's what we scheduled. However, it doesn't diminish the importance of that client for me. So I have my feelings about it, but my feelings are of very little consequence. For me, the logic is I still have respect for that client, and if I can't see the client, then I can't see the client. But abandoning the client is not one of the options that I hold myself out to have.
Right, and there's the whole process of writing letters and trying to get them.
I think the concern going to your initial point in terms of, you know, whether the phone calls were made or not, I still think the totality of finishing up a caseload and transitioning clients as clinicians, that requires the documentation of that. Like, that's part of it, which is why I asked about the circumstances of leaving. As a clinician, knowing that that's part of it, then you give more than 3.5 hours to know that you wrapped up your caseload, even if you're just leaving voicemails, even if you're just talking to your supervisor. But even 24, 48 hours, that to me would just make a difference in terms of at least trying to finish up your clinical obligation.
Yeah, and it's hard to talk about that. And I decided to talk to them about it. So that's a lot to consider. In this, and I do feel like it was at the very least unprofessional. And I think I'm kind of asking for you guys to decide if there should be a finding.
I'll just go. I feel like it's clear and convincing just with the resignation. Even with all of that, if I just took all of that out, we buy into this field knowing that we cannot leave on a dime. We just can't. And I so appreciated your differentiation between the agency, because if we're let go, the agency is taking that role. They're saying, we don't want you to worry about mm-hmm. of your clients.
That's right.
You'll do it all.
That's right.
And it relieves us of that obligation. But we go into this field knowing we just can't do that. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of rules and a lot of ethical codes around how do we leave appropriately. So when I see termination of clients, it's because we left our home. Sorry. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's pretty clear.
Yeah, crystal clear.
Okay, so then I would move that we make a finding of unprofessional conduct surrounding ARS 3235116S. Terminating behavioral health services to a client without making an appropriate referral for continuation of care for the client if continuing behavioral health services are indicated.
Is there a second?
Any second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Suggestions on how to move forward?
I think definitely what would be most helpful would be a consent agreement and then some education. Refresh, you know, you on all of the ethics. I think the staying out of trouble class would be very, very helpful. And then, or any equivalent one, and then also perhaps some training around documentation, what is most appropriate. And
3 CEs in documentation, or do we think more?
I think that's probably.
And the staying out of trouble does include somewhat of that, so the 3 plus the 6. So we'd be offering a consent agreement for 12 months. She'd be required to take 6 CEUs in staying out of trouble or the equivalent, as well as 3 CEUs in behavioral health documentation. And if not signed, invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remand to a formal hearing. Would that be a motion?
Is there a second?
Nope.
Roll call,
please. Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Mary Coonrod.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Trisha Dobratz.
Aye.
Annette Hennigan.
Aye.
Polly Knapp.
Aye.
Annalisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Motion carries. Board staff will follow up on all of this for you. Thank you. Best of luck to you. We will go to 7G, Magina Say, and I need to recuse from this, so I will be stepping away, and Dr. Bailey will take over.
I'm just seeing if the complainant is available in this matter. Will staff please give us a brief summary of the case?
Following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 3235116L, engaging in any conduct, practice, or condition that impairs the ability of the licensee to safely and competently practice the licensee's profession. And ARS 3235116B, using fraud or deceit in connection with rendering services as a licensee. This recommendation is based on the following. From 1217 to 821, licensee was employed at agency agency as a clinician providing behavioral health services to clients. In 8 of 21, there were concerns licensee was fraudulently billing for behavioral health services by inflating her time within progress notes. Due to these concerns, licensee was placed on administrative leave pending an investigation on 8-25-21. On 8-26-21, licensee resigned effective immediately while under investigation, which did not allow agency to interview licensee regarding the allegations of fraud. Agency had the data validation team conduct an audit from 9-20 to 8-21, which showed the following when reviewing the Zoom platform session times with the times licensee billed for. 559 services were padded, resulting in overpayment. Two instances of billed services overlapping. A total of 46,321 minutes was billed, but only 29,188 were accounted for when cross-referenced with the Zoom platform. 525 telehealth sessions were found to be padded for 82 different clients. $123,000 was reported as fraud, waste, and abuse. A spreadsheet with 10 examples comparing Zoom sessions, durations, and the time billed showed the following in part. Client 2 was billed for 103 minutes, but the Zoom session was only 58 minutes. Client 3 was billed for 81 minutes, but the Zoom session was only 36 minutes. Client 5 was billed for 119 minutes, but the Zoom session was only 59 minutes. During the investigative interview, licensee represented the following. She would bill for time she spent preparing clinical documentation on top of the time spent in session. Licensee had a previous supervisor who no longer works for agency inform her she could bill for time spent preparing clinical documentation. Licensee would have Zoom sessions get disconnected, so she would continue some of those sessions via telephone, so the Zoom times would not account for that. Licensee acknowledged fraudulently billing by including time spent on documentation within her session notes. Licensee further acknowledged attending various trainings at agency for billing and documentation. Licensee now realizes she could not have been billing for time spent on clinical documentation. It is highly concerning that within a 12-month period, licensee overbilled for 17,133 minutes of psychotherapy that are unaccounted for. 17,133 minutes amount to over 285 hours, meaning on average licensee fraudulently overbilled 5 hours weekly. Furthermore, from 3/18 to 6/21, licensee completed 2 agency trainings on billing and 4 trainings on fraud, waste, and abuse. Despite licensee completing numerous trainings around billing and fraud, licensee engaged in fraudulent billing practice as evidenced by her own admission and proof from agency internal audit. Even more concerning that licensee believes she can include time spent on preparing documentation without clients present in the billing times. Agency, in fact, sent checks to Access to pay for the overbilled services totaling over $123,000. Following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-325-16S, terminating behavioral health services to a client without making an appropriate referral for continuation of care for the client if continuing behavioral health services are indicated. This recommendation is based on the following. From 12/17 to 8/21, licensee was appointed agency. During an investigative interview, licensee represented she had a caseload of anywhere from 60 to 85 clients while employed at agency. In 8/21, after the concerns in regards to licensee fraudulently billing came in place, she was placed on administrative leave. Subsequently, licensee resigned effective immediately from her position without any sort of prior notice. Despite licensee being placed on administrative leave and agency taking all of her belongings, such as a laptop, phone, and client material, licensee abruptly resigned from her position without ensuring any sort of continuity of care for her 60-plus clients were in place. It was concerning that licensee was placed on administrative leave pending an investigation, and in the midst of the investigation, licensee immediately resigned without any notice to the agency or to her clients. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
I need to interrupt and recuse me.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Zavala. Do any board members have any questions for board staff? Okay. Ms. Saeed, is that
Saeed? Yes,
Saeed. Okay. You have an opportunity to address the board.
Okay. Thank you guys for giving me the opportunity to speak today. Please forgive me if I tremble with my words. So sitting here today in front of you all has been a moment that I have feared because of the choices that I have regretfully made. Above all the things that I say in these 5 minutes, I hope you know that my deepest disappointment is within myself.
and I am truly so sorry to the clients that were impacted by my decisions. I have had every opportunity to seek proper guidance and change my actions during my last year at Arizona Children's Association. Unfortunately, I did not, and there is no excuse or reason for fraudulently billing. I take full responsibility for the choices I made during that time period and cannot push blame on anyone else but myself because I knew better and I should have acted on that. I care very deeply and am very passionate about the years put into my education, the journey it took to getting my license, and mostly my client-therapist relationships. I never had the intention of leaving my clients behind without proper referrals and ensuring continuity of care. I was reassured of their care before my departure and made decisions based on the information given to me at that time. I wish I took the time to understand and comprehend how my actions would have led me here today. I can say with full sincerity that I am deeply regret the choices I made and understand completely the effects of my choices and will never repeat them ever again. I want the board to know that I didn't quit my hours for reasons that are unjustifiable. There was never any ill intentions behind my practices. The best way I could explain my rationale was billing for additional time, which she said spent treatment planning and documenting, to account for the demands of extra time spent on those specific cases. From there, it became practice for me to bill additional time for clients that I saw. I never received benefit or gain, I once again understand and fully comprehend how those practices are fraudulent. Although the report investigation finds that I abandoned my clients, I urge you to understand that I was instructed not to contact my clients by my supervisor, Deanna Hill, and HR Pamela Osborne. My phone and computer and any means to be able to contact my clients were immediately taken away from me. I asked HR multiple times. I asked HR multiple times about ensuring continuity of care for my clients, and she reassured me that they would find appropriate referrals and would contact my clients for me. I plead with you to see that matters of finding continuity of care were taken away from me. I care very, very deeply for the client-therapist relationships I built in session and wish I never put myself or them in this situation. For that, I understand and take full responsibility for the outcomes that come out of the situation and my decisions. I know I can't change the past, but if given the opportunity to, I will devote everything I have to changing the course of how I practice moving forward. Excuse me. My promises may not hold significance to you, but please note that I have since made every effort possible to make right choices and encourage others around me to do the same. I promise to practice ethically and responsibly. This process has not been easy, and rightfully so, I deserve to see the consequences of my actions, but I beg you to allow me to make light of what I've done. Please give me opportunity to educate myself and continue doing what I love, and worked so hard for. I owe it to my clients and I owe it to myself. Once again, I'm so sorry.
Thank you, Ms. Sayu.
Thank you.
Board members have any questions for the licensee? Okay. Now's the time for the board to deliberate. Ms. Palacios, do you want to lead us in our discussion?
Thank you, Ms. Sayed, for coming and presenting and reflection on your reflection on what has happened. And so thank you for appearing today. But due to the fraudulent documentation, that's pretty clear that according to ARS 32, 32, 51, 16, 1, ARS 32, 32, 51, 16, B, ARS 32, 32, 51, 16, F, so engage in any contact, practice, or condition of impossibility, or completely practice or licensing profession. Is it better to seek on a connection, rendering services of a licensing, or establishing qualifications for this chapter, and inappropriate termination of clients? My recommendation would be to find for violation.
Correction. I think she said 16-1. It was 16-L.
I'm 16-L.
It looks correct.
I'm sorry.
It looks like a 1 the way it's printed, but it is 16-L.
L, B, and F.
Second, Trotter.
Is there any conversation, though, around the termination, inappropriate termination of clients? I mean, I just, in light of what we were just talking about, I was just curious. Am I missing, I mean, I know that she resigned, but she was put on leave, and...
I know we discussed, I think with termination, she was on an admin leave, and then chose to terminate her own employment. Okay. The employer had not yet made the decision about what would happen again.
Fair enough.
If she would have chosen to see that out, if agency would have come, it would have been agency's responsibility. So she chose to terminate her own employment. It was her responsibility. Although she did not have the means to access clients, she had the means to access supervisors and ensure that appropriate referrals were made.
Thank you. I agree, and I appreciate that perspective, so thank you.
Okay.
Okay, were there any... Is that your motion?
Yes.
You want to make a motion?
Yes, that's my
okay.
motion. Uh-huh.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Was there a second on that? Okay. Sorry. Mm-hmm. Do you want me to repeat that? No. All those opposed? Motion carries. Would you like to suggest where we move forward?
Yes, I would. And so my recommendation would be a graduate course on behavioral health ethics, CEU, 6 hours of staying out of trouble, clinical supervision, the first year focusing for once a week, second year twice a month, and focusing on documentation, billing, and ethics. My concern, I think, again, is that there's 5 times since 2017 that fraud, waste, and abuse were taken. And that's why I'm recommending the graduate course on it, because there were multiple CEUs, and it seems like that wasn't, the information wasn't retained or put into practice.
You mentioned clinical supervision, but I don't believe that this individual is in private practice. So I wonder if this clinical supervision would be required as a part of whatever her next job is. Has the licensee taken a new job?
Yes.
Yeah, I forgot. Getting close to 100.
So
clinical supervision in the new job setting. That's what you're suggesting.
Yeah. It seems like she's not seeing clients. I think the current job is not clinical.
Dr. Bailey, may I address that? So what happens in these types of cases, because she currently does hold, you know, a license of ours at the associate level, if you believe that conduct requires clinical supervision, at this given time, she is in a non-clinical role where you can't get clinical supervision, but it's not uncommon for the board still to require it, and then what ends up happening, since she's not seeing clients, she will ask for what we call a stay. And so basically it'll be told, and then once she were to get into a position where she was seeing clients, she would be required to get clinical supervision. So that's not uncommon. It's something for the members to consider, because she could be in this clinical role non-clinical role till tomorrow, mm-hmm. till next year, and you know, maybe 10 years from now. I don't know what the purpose of the non-clinical role is, but if you felt clinical supervision was important, I think you could go ahead and include it, and she would just request tolling until she was in a position where she could get clinical supervision.
And because of the administrative responsibility of that, I would suggest that maybe we not include that at this time, and let's give the licensee a chance to satisfy the other requirements and just not include that one at this time.
Can I ask a point of clarity with that, and just tagging on to Doc? Would that let's say she was in this non-clinical role for the next 5 years, that would preclude her from ever being released from the consent agreement?
That is correct.
Supervision.
And that has happened, but to Mr. Davis's point, I mean, when he says at this time, there is no time to come back and include it.
Right.
So this would be the opportunity.
I would still like to recommend the clinical supervision. I'm open. It sounds like her intent is to have direct practice in this situation.
I mean, you could include there, you know, something to the effect it would be a little bit of a boutique, which we don't typically do, but you could put something to the effect of if she's in a clinical role in the next 5 years, she would have to do clinical supervision. If not, she could request release.
But she still then would be on a consent agreement for the next 5 years, technically.
Fair.
Possibly.
Fair.
Possibly.
I think it's doubtful, but I think that's a fair observation.
Can we ask her what her thought is about getting back into a clinical role? Would she think she might do that?
I don't know. Would you want to comment on that?
Yes. I definitely plan to go back to do therapy.
Okay.
I have my associate's license, so I do plan to finish my license. Mm-hmm. And I will need a supervisor, obviously, to do that too. I don't know if that. If, yeah. So
that is my goal.
I can't tell you when, though. Probably in the next year or so. That's my
Is there a way that we could have her do supervision, but she just doesn't have any clients? She could talk about client problems. She has clinical experience.
It would be very difficult because you wouldn't have a clinical record to review and the documentation and the updates on HIPAA and billing documentation might not be fully useful.
Okay.
You know, in view of the comment from the licensee, I'd go along with the requirement for clinical supervision because it may be told for now, but...
Can we have a discussion on how long for the clinical supervision? Because once she gets into that change of role, to a clinical role... You know, do we want her to be supervised for 12 months? Do we have a 24 months? No early release? Because it seems like it's kind of...
I think Ms. Palacio recommended once a week for the first 12 months,
okay.
And after that, the recommendation of the clinical supervisor no less than twice monthly.
Okay.
Okay, Ms. Mala, can you repeat all of that back for us? Thank you.
So we would be offering a consent agreement for 24 months. She would be required within the first 12 months to complete a 3-credit graduate level course in behavioral health ethics. She'd also be required to take the 6 CEUs of staying out of trouble or equivalent. Additionally, she'd be required to get clinical supervision. The clinical supervision would be once weekly for the first year at the recommendation of the clinical supervisor at the second year, no less than twice monthly. The focus on that would be billing, behavioral health ethics, documentation, board statutes and rules. And if not signed, she'd be invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remand to a formal hearing.
Make a motion?
Yes, I'd like to make a motion.
Is there a second?
Second.
Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Mary Coonrod.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Adelaide Sameek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Okay, motion carries. That concludes this matter. Ms. Saeed, thank you so much for being here. The decision will be mailed to you. You'll receive that, and if you have any questions, you may call board staff.
Okay, thank you.
Would reflect that Ms. Dobratz is returning promptly. As well as Ms. Knapp.
Well done, Dr. Bailey.
That concludes our disciplinary matters, I believe.
Are we okay
proceeding or okay. See that look, Mr. Trotter. We will go to agenda item number 10, our applications for licensure. Ms. Mello, do you want to speak to licenses issued?
Yes, since our last board meeting, we issued 204 licenses.
Wow.
Whoa. And on the agenda, there is A1, Mr. Klepper. Is there a motion to rescind the 610 motion to deny his application?
Davis moves it.
Is there a second?
Glossier, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And for denials, start with counseling.
Do you have something for us to read?
It's in the denial. Sorry, in your... Yep, that tab. Sorry.
All right, here we go.
Okay, so the Counseling Academic Review Committee has reviewed the applications of the following individuals. We have 5 applications based on a failure to pass the required examination. Those are denials. And then 5 applications based on failure to take the required examination. 1 application based on failure to meet minimum requirements for a total of 11.
Second? Bailey, second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Social work?
The Social Work Academic Review Committee has reviewed the applications of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure, 5 based on failure to pass the required examination, and 3 based on failure to take the required examination for a total of 8 denials.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
American Family Therapy Academic Review Committee has reviewed the applications of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. We have 1 application based on a failure to pass the required exam, 3 applications based on a failure to take the required exam, and 1 application based on a finding of unprofessional conduct for a total of 5 denials.
There a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Go to agenda item number 12, a report from Treasurer. I believe June needs to be tabled.
Correct.
Okay, you have before you the financial statement for the period ending in May. You guys can all take a look at that, and if there's any questions for board staff, I would invite those.
I just had a few very technical questions.
You can call board staff next week.
Thank you.
I have a motion to approve the financial statement for May.
Davis moves it.
Yeah, second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And that will bring us to Ms. Avellan, agenda item number 13.
All right. All right, Mr. Yabu, you have 60 seconds or less to talk about the rulemaking process.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the board. As far as the rulemaking process goes, as you're aware, we brought this to you a couple of months ago. The rulemaking process, we've embarked on this journey that I'm learning about. So with your permission and also the Governor's Office permission, we filed with the Secretary of State Office the notice of proposed rulemaking as well as the notice of docket opening. So what that means is that it is available for public feedback. Of course, you have a copy of that in your portal, and it is also posted on our website. We have an email dedicated to receiving feedback from the public that's posted on our website, and we also have oral proceedings scheduled for October 20th and the 25th, of course, posted on our website. So if any of you have any feedback regarding that draft, please feel free to let me know and Ms. Zavala know, because what will happen after the feedback is received, we'll incorporate that into the draft and then resubmit it to the Governor's Office for hopefully approval. So that's my hopefully 20-second overview of where we are. Sorry about that. For letter B, an update on the database, I'll start with the bad news. We do have to push the release date back just a hair to the end of August, maybe beginning of September. The reason for that is, I'll be frank, we're trying to create this portal that incorporates 4 different disciplines, tiered levels of licensure, and then all of those have individual requirements. So we're trying to squeeze that into the template that this company has given us, and it's doable, but it just takes some time. So we have customized about 25 different applications based on those different requirements and working through those. I think that's going to be the hardest most part. But the good news in that is we are going to see cost savings. People aren't going to have to print out paper and mail it into the board. And then on the flip side of that, our staff doesn't have to enter individually each of those applications into our archaic database. So we'll see cost savings, we'll see time efficiencies increase, all types of good things. It's just going to take us a little bit to get there. So we're working hard on it, and that's my update.
And Ms. Abbey has worked countless hours on both A and B, the rulemaking process and the database, so appreciate it very much. We're going to have a BMW-style database once it's all over. Promise me. So update on the state's 2023 budget. This is the state's budget, and I am very happy to say that we did officially get our three new staff members, and we are in the process of hiring them. And even more excitingly and even more importantly, and it kind of shows up my spine, each and every one of our staff, actually for the most part the state of Arizona, we're going to talk about our staff, they all got a 10% increase in their salaries. This is huge.
It's huge because it's well-deserved.
They were already underpaid, and it also helps with retention. Over the last couple of years, we've lost some significant staff members because we weren't able to do anything about it. I feel like our board takes rather good care of our staff the best we can, but we still have limits. So that was super exciting. I actually think I was on vacation when I sent them the email because I could hardly stand it. I was so excited to tell them.
I wonder, you have declined to take any increases for years.
It's automatic, Doc. I can't decline it. It's automatic. But it's effective July 9th, so I think it comes up on July 23rd's paycheck. So it's super exciting.
Excellent.
I could probably shed tears from my staff. Like, that's so well-deserved. Update on newsletter. For all of our professional members, you receive this via email. This is all fun. I think it's just beautiful. We've got a lot of really good feedback. We've gotten feedback like, I didn't know there were telepractice rules, which is a little concerning with that said. It is a way just really to communicate. There was a couple that said they wish there was more information on here. That's not the purpose. It's really just a newsletter, and hopefully to encourage people to go to our website and look at our website, hopefully for people to call and ask questions. So super excited about this. And for the public members, it's been uploaded to the portal. Email hack. So are computers back yet? Yeah. So we have two computers currently over at Homeland Security. So it does not appear that anything was compromised. However, we did have two of our staff members who emails were hacked. It was very nice to report the fact that it all occurred about like 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, and I think you were at home working and I was here, and I don't know, by 7:10 it felt like the whole world kind of knew. Meaning that we were on top of it, they were on top of it, and they came and confiscated two of our computers. So, and it is about our website. It was really just for the protection of our board, just in case someday something comes out, but we don't believe that anything was compromised. We did have one of our emails, we're sending our licensees emails asking them for passwords, so it could have been a lot worse. So I'm happy that we were able to respond quickly, but also the state responded very quickly, and Homeland Security was sending us emails. So, and then just an update on my attendance at the National Conference of State Legislators. This was a very quick impromptu conference that I went to that was based. Basically, the National Council of State Legislators were putting on this conference in Vegas. Sounds super cool. It was super not cool. It was a day and a half. There were a lot of legislators there throughout the entire country. There was a couple of, workers from the state legislators that were there. Unfortunately, none of our senators or representatives were there. It was really about mobility of licensure and the importance of compacts and the importance of how we're going to have to figure out what this looks like. There was also a very strong portion of it that included the deregulation piece that kind of talked about, like, if our states can't can't figure out how to work together. They're going to keep, you know, picking apart professions and deregulating them. So I think it just reminds us how important it is for us to get that word out there next year for the counseling compact. The social work compact that I was part of, that draft actually just went out this morning. This is we need to get on board. So hopefully next year we can get on board with all this. And that's all I have. And just for the record, Dr. Bailey, 11 minutes. Knock on wood. Number 15, do we have any future agenda items?
I'd like to propose one.
Okay. This is your chance to do so.
Wasn't it wrong? So kind of a theme I'm seeing is that a training for persons that are seeking professional licensure and supervision. Or something like that. I don't know if we could talk about that further.
Just for clarification, for board to put that on?
Or like a tutorial or
okay. Yeah. Okay.
I think it's more of a private practice and that type of expectation. I know we have in the past done a tutorial on, like, you know, if you have a court-appointed licensee, but this is the process to you know, bring it before the board where we can actually act. The same thing for the private practice. I think there's some, well, we see what happens. So there's a need, I think, for an additional tutorial so that if they do visit our website, you know, lower level licensing, they can kind of once again, you know, be have another resource to kind of see a short little video, because sometimes that's easier than, you know, reading policy, obviously. So
I'm putting up the other training.
Okay, and I can't respond to that right now because for a future agenda item, but I heard you. I will put it on here. We'll make sure we get it on the agenda for the August 19th board meeting.
Anything else for future agenda item?
Yes, future agenda item. I always have a lot of compassion for the people who are involved with the court-appointed the court-appointed monitors. I wonder if it'd be a good idea to have something on the agenda about that, so that we are on record.
I knew what it was.
I know, but
you want to do it again?
I wonder.
Okay.
You know, because it just keeps coming up.
And it has for 12 years. But I will put it on the future agenda, and maybe we can discuss further what that looks like. I'm not sure a repeat for our board members, but I'll go ahead and put that on the agenda.
And honestly, it isn't even for the board members. It's so that we can demonstrate that we understand the difficulty of it. We don't have control over it. We only have control over the discussion.
Any other future agenda items?
Okay. I was going to say, I know that right now there's not a lot of information, but I think for the future, how can clinicians address the Roe versus Wade, and what is the responsibility of clinicians? How do we advocate, protect clients, all of that. So that's kind of something I don't know when we would be able to address that, but just it's floating around.
I think we have to, and I don't mean to sweep Ms. Zavala or Ms. Baskin, but I think we have to be very careful with the fluidity of that, and I believe there was more news while we've been in this meeting today, so.
Well, yes, I expect so.
Madam Chair, I think it'd be best if I probably reach out. We do it maybe in a different way.
Yeah. Else. All right. This would be our call for public comment. This would be a chance if anybody would like to address the board. You would have up to 5 minutes to do so. We can't engage or answer any questions, but if they would like to come forward, we finally have somebody other than our staff out there at this time. So anybody wish to address? Okay. And again, we can't engage or answer any questions, but if you'll state your name for the record, and then you would have up to 5 minutes.
Okay. So my name is Dolly Morello. I am a first-year MSW student at ASU. I just want to say thank you for having me. I
I hear a lot from other professionals I work with about the importance of maintaining your license and just being careful and doing your due diligence when you work. But I think coming here really helped me see, like, all the things I don't think about when I think about practicing and I think about using my degree in the future. So I want to thank you for being so, like, thorough in some of your explanations, because I think as a student, being present here helped me understand what I need to look forward into, but also valuing the things that I already do now and the experience I have. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you for being here, and spread the word.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I will. I have been here for a class. I'll let them know, but it's not as bad as they might think it will be.
Yeah. For the record, could you please spell your name?
CaliaMurillo.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to address the board? And if you would state your name for the record, and then you would have up to 5 minutes.
My name is Crystal Nelson. I'm an MSW student as well, and this has been very eye-opening. I think every student should come to a board meeting just so they can put into perspective what is required, you know, what the code of ethics are speaking about, because it makes you really, really put things into perspective. I am a nurse as well, so I understand about the documentation and I understand all of that, but to put it into perspective of counseling and social work and all the other things that you have to do, I think it's really important. So when I go back to class, I'm going to post all kinds of stuff. You know, and quite honestly, I honestly think this should be a part of the curriculum that they attend the meeting. So thank you guys very much.
Thank you. Absolutely. If it continues to follow suit like this, because this is a good way to end the meeting. So my name is Cameron Michael, and I'm an LAC, and I just want to say thank you for letting us come and be here. I think it was, like she said, very eye-opening to just, like, I'm sitting back there, I'm like, oh my gosh, am I doing everything right? And, like, you know, and I think it's just so important. I think it was good that I came. So just thank you. Thank you for allowing me to be here and learn.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Beautiful way to end.
Absolutely. Next meeting is Friday, August 19th. Isabella, do we have a take on anybody that will not be here?
Nobody has told me they weren't going to be here.
Any other board members that know they will not be here, please let Isabella know sooner rather than later. Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved. Got it.
Is there a second?
Second.
All right, everybody have a good day. Thank you so much.